Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Remember, folks, this is Friday early start day, and so the reason we do that is because Shirley Watchell comes on at 6:30, so we start at 6 o'clock on Fridays instead of our move-to time of 7, and of course, Thursdays, we've even changed again. We're on at 10 in the morning until 1 p.m., mostly for Judy Mikovits, who's on the West Coast, otherwise she's up at, like, what, 4? We don't want to do that to Judy. So we changed the time around there a little bit, but she's missed the last couple of weeks, so I'm going to talk to the gang and see if Dr. Mikovits can't make it, should we, you know, reschedule earlier or something like that? We'll figure it out anyway. Yesterday's show was outstanding, and we came up with a bunch of very interesting things. The group has gone from complaining to actual, you know, what do we do about it? And, of course, that's the whole purpose of Action Radio anyway, is to take everything from, you know, the complaining stage and actually do something. And what we decided to do was to try and seek an overturn of the emergency use authorization for vaccines, which are not vaccines, which aren't needed because there's no emergency, especially when it comes to kids. And so it's a fascinating show if you get a chance to listen to it from yesterday, just the amount of stuff that we went over. And we had a couple of folks join us, Jonathan Mosley, our legal reporter, who's been really busy lately, but managed to snag him for yesterday, came back and talked about all the legal aspects and how to do this in the Administrative Procedures Act and where the government failed to follow any kind of procedure in terms of making the jab, the emergency use authorization, through a legal process. See, not only does the government have to do things that are legal, they have to follow the legal way to do it. And that's where the Administrative Procedures Act comes in. And, of course, they didn't do that. So we're going to go around and see if we can find a judge now and take this and overturn it. And so overturn the emergency declaration because there is no emergency. And the person that really, you know, throws all this together is John Cullen, because John has the data. He's the guy that created the map that you saw for COVID on all the Johns Hopkins websites. So that's him. So he's our data guy, you know, on the panel. Plus, we have Drs. Mikovits, Thorpe, Ardis, Marble, and other folks that join us. We also have Tiffany Parato, who's a Florida activist, marketing guru genius. And we talked about the aspects of COVID, you know, the fact, and it was only in the last few minutes. So we're going to pick this up again, I think, next week, but that COVID is the most brilliant yet diabolical medical holocaust combination of a fascist combination of big government and big pharma to create a marketing scheme that, you know, promotes a vaccine that actually destroys your immune system and actually, you know, spreads the diseases that it tries to, that it says it's going to eradicate. So it actually does exactly the opposite as intended, thus creating an endless market for it. Because people think they're getting it to boost their immune system when it's destroying it, which means people are susceptible to more diseases, more variants, more things like that. And so they get more of the product thinking that's going to help them, but it actually is destroying them because it's taking out their immune system at the same time and actually spreading, you know, more and more of the disease. So what better marketing scheme for a vaccine than one that destroys your immune system and gives you more disease? And then the cure, of course, is more vaccine. You know, this is what we talked about yesterday. So if you haven't heard the yesterday show, please do. Yesterday's show was outstanding. Today, hopefully, we'll do the same, but we'll see. Anyway, of course, the big news is the Supreme Court actually read the Second Amendment and tried to implement it. But, of course, they screwed up as usual. There is, like everything else out of the Supreme Court, good news and bad news. Fortunately, there's some very good news. They actually read the Second Amendment and ruled New York's Sullivan Law as unconstitutional, that you can't carry a gun outside the home. Now, I don't know where this came from. Somewhere along the way, I think it was the Sullivan Law itself, that this split, that there's somehow a difference in your rights between inside the home and outside the home. You know, do you have a right of free speech inside the home? You know, but you don't have a right of free speech outside the home? Does due process only apply inside the home? So that when the feds, you know, rip you out of your bedroom and out of your front door in the middle of the night, do you suddenly lose your due process rights outside the home? So this distinction is hysterical and illegal at the same time, which is what most of the Supreme Court decisions seem to me to be, both illegal and hysterical. And they seem to run concurrent. One of the more amusing parts, one of the more redeeming parts of this decision yesterday, besides the fact that they made the right decision, but they did it for all the wrong reasons. Okay, so there's the dichotomy again. This is the Marxian dialectic of the Supreme Court, is that a lot of times they will make a decent decision and do it for reasons that will actually make for more trouble later on. And of course, Heller and McDonald, those decisions made for far more trouble later on, ruling that the Second Amendment isn't absolute, when of course it is. And that the reasonable restrictions are okay, that it's not an unlimited right, which that's not true either. So we're going to go through it. But I've got a little bit of time before Shirley gets here at 6:30. And so I wanted to cover the best way to cover the dissent, which drags on forever and is totally wrong and bogus and emotional talking points, not actually constitutional law. That's what the left does. They give you emotional talking points and presume that it'll pass for constitutional law and legitimate constitutional arguments, which, of course, it doesn't. Pointing that out in excruciatingly amusing detail is Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito, who says, "I join the opinion of the court in full, but add the following comments in response to the dissent." Now, he starts off wrong, but I'll get to where the good part is as we do. I'm going to try and get through the whole thing. It's only about 8 pages. All right. He says, "Much of the dissent seems designed to obscure the specific question that the court has decided, and therefore it may be helpful to provide a succinct summary of what we have actually held." Because the dissent doesn't actually talk about what they actually held. It goes off in weird tangents and emotional diatribes and other, you know, meaningless stuff. All right. Alito says, "In District of Columbia v. Heller, the court concluded that the Second Amendment protects the right to keep a handgun in the home for self-defense. Why that had to be stated is kind of bizarre to me. Of course, the Second Amendment, you know, says you can have a right to a handgun, but D.C. said no. They actually read the Second Amendment, which says the right of the people to keep and bear arms, to own and carry arms, and said, well, that doesn't apply in the home. It doesn't apply outside either. You know, so they actually ruled against it in both places, which is intellectually impossible. But if you're a Marxist, tyrannical government, then of course it makes perfect sense because nobody has rights. That's their view. All right. Alito says Heller found that the amendment codifying Heller found that the amendment codified a pre-existing right, this is in other words before the Constitution, and that this right was regarded at the time of the amendment's adoption as rooted in, quote, the natural right of resistance and self-preservation. So self-defense is a natural right. The implements of self-defense are the firearms in many cases, and therefore firearms are part of your natural right to self-defense. That's what he's saying. He didn't say it like I just did, which is kind of too bad, actually. I like the way that came out. All right, then he says the inherent right of self-defense, Heller explained, is central to the Second Amendment. Okay, well, in a way, that's kind of a problem, too, because the Second Amendment doesn't need a justification. It just says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And from that is the militia clause, which says a well-regulated regulated militia, which doesn't mean government-regulated. It means well-armed, which means a well-armed citizen, you know, group, independent of government, is necessary for the security of a free state. Now, is that free state Florida, or is that free state a state of freedom? So in other words, is it a geographical state, or is it a conditional state? I'm gonna hit Jim and Shirley with that one too, because the Second Amendment doesn't say. So I look at it when it says a well-regulated militia is necessary for the security of a free state. It is necessary for us to maintain our freedom to be able to arm ourselves in groups of citizens and arm ourselves well. You know, well-regulated means well-armed, okay? And in order for us to be well-regulated, in other words, in order for civilians to be well-armed and form citizen militias, we have to have the right to keep and bear arms, okay? So in other words, the amendment is backwards. It should have said the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed because a well-regulated militia is necessary for the security of a free state. And had I been around in 1791, that's exactly what I would have said. You guys have written it backwards. And because you wrote it backwards, you screwed up the country for over 200 years. Idiots. You should have written it properly. You know, and that's the way that you should read the Second Amendment. It should say the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. Actually, I wouldn't even say because. I would actually make them two separate clauses. So let me correct that just in case people say, well, you just said that the militia is dependent, the right of the people is dependent on the militia, and I don't want to say that. So let me rephrase as I'm improvising and just kind of thinking off the top of my head here, extemporaneously talking. All right. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, comma, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. A well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. You know what? I would even drop that part. Let's just take the Second Amendment and make it simple. The right of the people to keep and bear arms can't be touched. That's what the Second Amendment should have said. All right, let's get back to Alito. He says, much of the dissent seems designed to obscure the specific question that the court has decided, and therefore it may be helpful to provide a succinct summary of what we have actually held. I think I already read that part. Okay. Although Heller concerned the possession of a handgun in the home, the key point we decided was that the people, not just the members of the militia, here we go, have the right to use a firearm to defend themselves. And that's key. That is actually really good. He says, Heller concerned the possession of a handgun in the home. The key point that we decided was that the people, not just members of the militia, have the right to use a firearm to defend themselves. That really is critical. So that was done well. And because many people face a serious risk of lethal violence when they venture outside their homes, the Second Amendment was understood at the time of adoption to apply under those circumstances. See, I don't think it matters. And I don't think there is no distinction in the Second Amendment. You know, home, inside the home, outside the home. That's crazy. You know, or the apartment or the workplace or anywhere else. There is no distinction. You have the right, you either have the right to keep and bear arms or you don't. Where you keep and bear arms is, you know, up to you. Although a lot of government regulations would disagree with that. I think that, anyway, we'll talk about that later. That will get more complicated. Anyway, he says the Second Amendment was understood at the time of adoption to apply under those circumstances. The court's exhaustive historical survey, which I thought was unnecessary, established that point very clearly, and today's decision therefore holds that a state may not enforce a law like New York's Sullivan Law that effectively prevents its law-abiding residents from carrying a gun for this purpose. Sullivan, I believe, was Irish. I believe this was a discrimination originally against the Irish because the Irish were thought of as second-class citizens, and so therefore you couldn't have your second-class citizens, just like blacks in the South, carrying guns. And, you know, so the Irish in the North and the blacks in the South, there was bigotry and discrimination and racism and nationalism against certain nations and certain colors, and that's how that works. And Pianki's already here, so let's bring him right on. Are you enjoying my discussion of the dissent of Sam Alito? Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Greg. You're wilding at it. That's a good thing.
I got some sleep last night, I think. Something went right. Well, this is my favorite time of year. To me, you know, some people enjoy sports. They enjoy the playoffs. They enjoy, you know, movies. They enjoy things like that. To me, I enjoy Supreme Court decisions. I'm kind of weird. So this is my sport. This is my amusement. This is my fun, is going over these things in excruciating detail and showing what idiots they are. And I sort of wonder in most cases how they ever got out of law school at all, especially the leftist judges. So if you have a question, please ask. Otherwise, I shall proceed with Alito's dissent.
Yeah, let's proceed with Alito's dissent.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. All right.
And keep in mind, Jackson is on the outskirts ready to take his place, probably with
not
the
Alito.
Same work.
Now, she could say Breyer's place, not Alito's.
Breyer, you're right. I'm sorry. But you can tell what's on my mind.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Breyer, whose family, I guess, makes ice cream, is the one who wrote the dissent. And his dissent really sucks because it is an emotional talking point series that is irrelevant to the court decision. So let's get back to Alito. Now, it gets fun here in just a second. He says, that is all we decide. And, of course, I think that's a mistake. He says, that is all we decide. Our holding decides nothing about who may lawfully possess a firearm or the requirements that must be met to buy a gun. Okay, in other words, if you have the right to keep and bear, then you cannot restrict the keeping of bearing by deciding who can own a gun and how they can purchase it. That's a separate issue. So this is where the court failed. Their decision is way too narrow in my view. He also says, nor does it decide anything about the kinds of weapons that people may possess. Well, that's not their choice either. If you have the right to keep and bear arms, you have the right to keep and bear arms of your choice. The government has no interest in that or no ability to regulate that either. All right. Nor have we disturbed anything that we said in Heller or McDonald v. Chicago about restrictions that may be imposed on the possession or carrying of guns. Well, that's a mistake too. So now he's made three mistakes. He's made three constitutional mistakes in one paragraph. Okay. This is where they're screwing up because they made it so narrow. Oh, we can't touch this. We can't touch that. We can't violate Heller or McDonald. We can't violate precedent, that they actually, in each of those cases, limited the Second Amendment in ways that they may not have intended to, but they certainly did. And as each case builds on each other case, they are forced to, through precedent, maintain the restrictions on the Second Amendment that were illegal when those initial decisions were first written. Make sense? He's thinking. I'll continue on. So Alito says, in light of what we have actually held, it is hard to see what legitimate purpose can possibly be served by most of the dissent's lengthy introductory section. Why, for example, does the dissent think it is relevant to recount the mass shootings that have occurred in recent years? Yeah, because those happen in places where guns aren't allowed. And of course, those are criminal actions, and criminal actions are outside and have nothing to do with the Second Amendment. Yeah, that's the argument. Well, we have to restrict the honest people because criminals are doing bad things. Again, that's like saying, well, we have to take away bank depositors because people rob banks. You know, the two have nothing to do with each other. They're irrelevant. There is a wall of separation between criminals and law-abiding citizens. Okay, and that wall is actually, you know, who gets to exercise rights and who through due process has basically given them up. Let me get back to the opinion here. He says, why, for example, does the dissent think it relevant? Okay, does the dissent think that laws like New York's prevent or deter such atrocities? Will a person bent on carrying out a mass shooting be stopped if he knows that it is illegal to carry a handgun outside the home? And how does the dissent account for the fact that one of the mass shootings near the top of the list took place in Buffalo? The New York law at issue in this case, obviously. Pianki, you get as hard as I do with this constant reference to criminals, and that somehow criminals are connected to the Second Amendment, that somehow the rights of the law-abiding are dependent on whether criminals commit crimes or not. That, to me, is irrational. They are so separate. There is no connection whatsoever, and yet that's the argument all the time. Marjorie Taylor Greene was before a press conference, and some British twit reporter said, well, we don't have all the mass shootings you do. And to which Marjorie Taylor Greene responded, you know, pretty well. But she should have said, well, of course, our mass shootings only happen in places where the Second Amendment is completely obliterated, where it doesn't exist. Anyway, am I still broadcasting? You out there?
Well, that's a good point you make there. And when we were born, you know, there exist human beings before there exists government. Of course, before government, there was no laws.
Mm-hmm.
So the old cliche that you were born with all the rights of the entire universe, it stands to reason. And then government comes along and restricts those things, which they shouldn't do. Now, there could be some regulations in certain cases, we can understand. It should follow along societal norms. You know, parents would let their children smoke cigarettes. Okay, well, then you can put some regulation on the sale so that children don't get a hold of. But the thing is, when it comes down to these other inalienable rights, they should prevail. It just should be merely reading the Constitution instead of going through all these debates and arguments.
Yeah, that's exactly my point too, and I think you're right on the fact that they have to go through these historical gyrations and precedents and all this other crap when all they really have to do is say the Second Amendment says. Okay, they never say that. The Second Amendment says that the right of the people to keep and bear arms, in other words, to own and carry firearms, can't be touched, can't be encroached upon. Therefore, any law that is, any law that tries to do that, and of course, laws are subordinate to the Constitution and therefore, you know, don't exist in terms of the Constitution. Any law that does that is automatically unconstitutional. That's the argument I made before, that gun control laws are always statutory, but statutory law is subordinate to constitutional law. Therefore, it doesn't matter what the gun infringement is. It's automatically unconstitutional, whether it has a great purpose or whether the Supreme Court says there can be reasonable restrictions or they have intermediate or strict scrutiny. None of that stuff matters because all these laws are statutory and statutory laws are under the Constitution. So it's all moot. So they went through about 80 pages of nonsense for no reason. That's the problem I have.
Right. And these arguments and presenting these examples, which are designed to get one better than you, is just fruitless. Just go back to what the doggone thing says. It's simple as – it's clear as a bell.
Yeah, but see, they can't do that because of their – well, they can't because of their education, their brainwashing, their culture. You know, the culture of the law. You know, I was listening to Dershowitz last night, who totally screwed things up too. By the time you've gotten through law school and become a lawyer and a judge and then a Supreme Court justice, you're so into the club that you don't think anything other than what the club thinks. And this is why they always go to precedent and pass Supreme Court decisions. They never actually novelly just, you know, read the Constitution and say, this is what the Constitution says. This is why the law is wrong. The law is overturned. you know, I could write most of these Supreme Court opinions in a paragraph.
Yeah, it's as clear as Greg, it's as clear as a stop sign.
Right.
Why would you argue with the stop sign? It
exactly.
tells you stop.
Yeah.
It doesn't say stop a little bit or stop just here. It says stop. Simple as that.
It doesn't say stop if it's reasonable. If we determine it's a reasonable stop. You know, you don't have to rationalize it. Yeah. No, exactly. And this is
and
the problem
the
with the Supreme Court.
Thing,
yeah.
The next thing, Greg, is states whose constitution also are obligated to the U.S. Constitution, they should say it, they should just say, as I say many times, hell no.
Mm-hmm.
It's unconstitutional.
Well,
hell no.
Well, the
if
states
you had more
that
of that going on.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well,
you know, if you had more of that going on. Yeah, if you had more of that going on, these judges wouldn't even think twice.
Well, for juries, too, don't forget, if we empower juries properly, if juries were taught their power to nullify unconstitutional law, see, the real power of the judiciary is in the jury. And so we forget that.
You are absolutely right.
That jury nullification, jury is the strongest component of the judicial system, even above the Supreme Court, because the jury represents the people and the court represents the government. And if the people are supreme to the government, then the jury is supreme to the judge or justices or the Supreme Court. And people don't understand that. And that would go a long way, that if these cases went to trial, criminal courts, and the jury said, no, that law is unconstitutional. You know, so the idea that the Supreme Court is the only place where laws can be overturned is crazy. Now, I used to think that we should take that power away, but I've modified my position on that. That the Supreme Court, in order to settle disputes and settle cases, has to be able to rule things unconstitutional. However, they cannot prescribe a remedy. They cannot prescribe a regulation. They cannot prescribe the conditions. They cannot set reasonable, unreasonable, strict scrutiny, intermediate scrutiny. They cannot create tests. They cannot do anything of the kind. Either a law is constitutional or it's not. There is no in-between. There is no wiggle room here. There is no, as we talked about the other day, this leaky ground in the middle. Remember the First Amendment discussion we had?
Yeah, absolutely right. There should not be anything said or in this case.
Yeah. Well, this is why all rights are absolute. You can't say that you have the right to keep and bear arms except. Well, then it's not a right. You've automatically violated the Constitution with the word except. Anyway, let me continue on because some of this stuff is kind of fun. So then he says, this is Alito again, he says, well, a person says, what is the relevance of statistics? And what he's doing is he's criticizing the dissent by Stephen Breyer. He says, what is the relevance of statistics about the use of guns to commit suicide? Does the dissent think that a lot of people who possess guns in their homes will be stopped or deterred from shooting themselves if they cannot lawfully take them outside? That's actually kind of funny. The dissent cites statistics about the use of guns in domestic disputes. But it does not explain why these statistics are relevant to the question presented in this case. How many of the cases involving the use of a gun in a domestic dispute occur outside the home? And how many are prevented by laws like New York's? The dissent cites statistics on children and adolescents killed by guns. But what does this have to do with the question whether an adult who is licensed to possess a handgun may be prohibited from carrying it outside the home? Our decision, as noted, does not expand the categories of people who may lawfully possess a gun. Well, that's too bad. And federal law generally forbids the possession of handgun by a person who is under the age of 18 and bars the sale possession of a handgun by a person under 18 and bars the sale of a handgun to anyone under the age of 21. Okay, so possession 18, sale to 21. Of course, that's unconstitutional too. If you have the right to possess, you have the right to buy. So there's a violation of the Constitution right there as well. Then he says, the dissent cites the large number of guns in private hands, nearly 400 million, but it does not explain what this statistic has to do with the question whether a person who already has the right to keep a gun in the home for self-defense is likely to be deterred from acquiring a gun by the knowledge that the gun cannot be carried outside the home. And while the dissent seemingly thinks that the ubiquity of guns and our country's high level of gun violence provide reasons for sustaining the New York law, the dissent appears not to understand that it is these very facts that cause law-abiding citizens to feel the need to carry a gun for self-defense. See, that last part is brilliant. He thinks, you know, like he says here,
I think there should be at least 640 million guns in the United States. One for the left hand, one for the right.
Well, see, I always toss around the idea of whether I want to carry a single-action revolver when we can go open carry. But I'd never carry one because they take too long to reload. So I'd have to carry two. So I'd get myself a Western rig with two six guns. That's why I used to carry two guns in the old days, you know, because it took too long to reload. So you might need 12 rounds. So everybody carried two. Most people carry two guns. All right. But that's
another
chat.
They don't case about in the house or outside. Suppose someone wants to sleep out in the yard one summer night. Now what?
How about on the those rooftop balconies in New York apartments? Is that outside the home?
But here's the thing again. We should not be getting into these exemplary examples where you're trying to get, I got one better than that. I got one better than that. No, the Constitution is absolute. That's all you need to confer to.
Yeah, but unfortunately, they don't teach that in law school, so these lawyers and judges never seem to understand that, which is why we have to tell them. All right, this part is brilliant, though. He talks about the dissent, you know, Stephen Breyer and the leftists. The reason that they say that you need this unconstitutional law is because there's a high level of gun violence. However, what he says is it's the very reason people are buying guns is because that level of gun violence, you know, he doesn't say it, but it's really that gun violence is created by the lack of a Second Amendment being enforced in these large cities. So to create more laws to take gun rights away creates the very violent situation that people want to have guns in the first place, which they can't because they've had laws that take those rights away. It's a circular logic that's really quite fascinating. The left never seems to understand that it's the fact that you've created these laws. You've created these violent zones and that people want to have guns. And what are you doing? You're going after the people that want to defend themselves rather than the people committing the crimes. That's ass backwards. to put it bluntly. Here's more. This is kind of fun. He says, no one apparently knows how many of the 400 million privately held guns are in the hands of criminals, but there can be little doubt that many muggers and rapists are armed and are undeterred by the Sullivan Law. Each year, the New York City Police Department confiscates thousands of guns, and it is fair to assume that the number of guns seized is a fraction of the total number held unlawfully. The police cannot disarm every person who acquires a gun for use in criminal activity, nor can they provide bodyguard protection for the state's nearly 20 million residents or the 8.8 million people who live in New York City. Some of these people live in high-crime neighborhoods. Some must traverse dark and dangerous streets in order to reach their homes after work or other evening activities. Some are members of groups whose members feel especially vulnerable. I think that would be minorities, but he's not saying it. And some of these people reasonably believe that unless they can brandish or, if necessary, use a handgun in the case of an attack, they may be murdered, raped, or suffer some other serious injury. He's absolutely right.
Well, so he's trying to explain to an idiot. It is required you to draw examples. It is required you to make mannequins in different poses. It is required you to explain things beyond the usual. And that's what he's trying to do.
Well, he's really trying to explain it to the dissent and why they're wrong. So you just called Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan idiots, which I tend to agree with. Well, Breyer's not an idiot, but he certainly is a leftist ideologue and doesn't understand the Constitution. All right, let me continue on here. We're almost Shirley's going to join us in just a couple minutes. He also says ordinary citizens frequently use firearms to protect themselves from criminal attack. And he goes on and says firearms used 2.5 million times. Da, 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 da. Okay, so it's basically his let me see if I can find let me get past the evidence here. I want to get to – all right, let me start the second part here. He says this brings me to part 2B of the dissent. He says, which chastises the court for deciding this case without a trial and factual findings about just how hard it is for a law-abiding New Yorker to get a carry permit. The record before us, however, tells us everything we need on this score. At argument, New York's Solicitor General was asked about an ordinary person who works at night and must walk through dark and crime-infested streets to get home. The Solicitor General was asked whether such a person would be issued a carry permit if she pleaded, there had been a lot of muggings in this area and I am scared to death. The Solicitor General's candid answer was, in general, no. To get a permit, the applicant would have to show more, for example, that she had been singled out for attack. He says, a law that dictates that answer violates the Second Amendment. He's absolutely right. That's it right there. New York doesn't give anybody, well, they gave Donald Trump a permit, but unless you're rich and powerful, and it's really an elitist, horrible thing the way they were doing it.
Well, yes, they're they're trying to qualify people the same way you've seen the case with the religious example. I don't think that you are sincere in your religious conviction. I kind of raise it. Who the hell is supposed to make that decision? That's that individual and their relationship with their God, not for somebody on the outskirts to make that decision.
Yeah, when did a religious exemption? Yeah, when did a religious exemption become a sincere religious exemption? And who decides? That's like, you know, the good faith belief. And if you start judging people's sincerity in their religion, then you're taking away their right to practice it as they see fit. All right, Shirley's on the line. Obviously, we're just going to kind of leap right into this. So let me get her report started. And, of course, she might have other things to talk about, which is fine, too. Be right back.
When one is faced with a crisis, you find your true character. How you react to such an emergency can determine the rest of your life. Two paths present themselves for you to choose. One leads to tragedy. The other leads to becoming a new person. Shirley Wattrall, a survivor of a dangerously abusive relationship, is that new person. She is the author of Heels to Holster. She is a firearms instructor, motivational speaker, women's empowerment advocate, and a reporter for Action Radio. So now, here is the DC Project, Women and Guns, with Shirley Wattrall.
Yeah. Good morning, Shirley. What should we talk about?
Good morning. A lot of exciting stuff going on, isn't there?
Well, it's Supreme Court season. You know, people like, some people, as I explained to Bianchi, some people like baseball season. Some people like, you know, the theater season. Me, I like Supreme Court season. So we're right in the middle of Supreme Court season. This is like the playoffs when they start releasing all the decisions. So I'm having a great time.
Yes. What are you guys, reading through? I just caught the last 5 minutes.
Let me finish it because I'm
almost
done.
Yeah, go ahead because I'm going to need to leave it. I got to go teach class. Second Amendment. I gotta go help someone practice their Second Amendment. So I will be leaving.
Can you give details like where you teach or anything like that? Anything that you can share, or you know, we might as well share how people can contact you too. Let's get that. Let's do that right now, especially for lessons.
I teach. I do go to the outdoor range. It's in Collier County in Florida. It's called Blue Land, and I like it because it's outdoor. I love teaching outdoors. And if anyone in the area of Naples, Fort Myers area wants to take a lesson, they can contact me at my work number, 941-677-3377. And, yeah, I do a lot of private sessions, and this is a woman that's wanting to learn to handle. She's got a firearm. She wants to be more proficient with it and feel more confident with it. So that's what we'll be working on today.
Excellent. Hey, let me know if you get any Canadians coming down to take classes with you. And the reason I say that is because our Canadian audience has like quadrupled in the last 5 months. I don't know what's going on, but Canada is really starting to reach out. Ever since they lost their gun rights and lost their other rights and the freedom convoys and things like that, Australia's up and England's up too. So the English-speaking world, the British Commonwealth, you know, the former countries, you know, Canada, Australia, as well as England, our audience has doubled in those countries, but Canada's really taken off. And so it's really quite exciting what's happening. So a lot of Canadian snowbirds come to Florida. So don't be surprised if you get some Canadian citizens that want to learn about it, even if they can't exercise that right in Canada.
Right. That's good to know. So are you reading through the 135 pages of the briefing?
Oh, no. I wouldn't waste my whole show with that. I got some of it, though. Well, I'm going to do about 18 pages of Justice Thomas's opinion. I'm not even bothering with the dissent because they're idiots. So I'm reading Alito's critique of the dissent because it's only 8 pages. It's a lot shorter, and he makes fun of them so well that I can only pick on the things that he doesn't do where he had the opportunity. So let me just finish this, and then we can chat. He says, my final point, this is Alito, he says, my final point concerns the dissent complaint that the court relies too heavily on history and should instead approve the sort of, quote, means end analysis employed in this case by the Second Circuit. Under that approach, a court in most cases assesses a law's burden on the Second Amendment right and the strength of the state's interest in imposing the challenge restriction. Well, I'm going to talk about that because that's completely wrong. Anyway, he says this mode of analysis places no firm limits on the ability of judges to sustain any law restricting the possession or use of a gun. I don't quite understand how, I think he wrote that backwards. But let me give the examples and see if it makes sense. He says the first is the Second Circuit's decision. This is what they overturned the Second Circuit. This is what this case really concerns. He says the Second Circuit's decision in a case the court decided 2 terms ago. New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, City of New York. This is one that Jim Dykes was telling us all about as it was going through. He says the law in that case affected New York City residents who had been issued permits to keep a gun in the home for self-defense. The city recommended that these permit holders practice at a range to ensure that they are able to handle their guns safely, but the law prohibited them from taking their guns to any range other than the 7 that were spread around the city's 5 boroughs. Imagine having to get a license to keep a gun in your home, you know, and a permit to use it in your home. That in itself is hysterical. Anyway, he says, even if such a person unloaded the gun, locked it in the trunk of their car, and drove to the nearest range, that person would violate the law if the nearest range happened to be outside city limits. The Second Circuit held that the law was constitutional, which, of course, is intellectually impossible, as we know. He says, concluding, among other things, that the restriction was substantially related to the city's interest in public safety and crime prevention. This is what we need to talk about because this is really key. All right. He says, but after we agreed to review that decision, the city repealed the law and admitted that it did not actually have any benefit effect on public safety. So citizens of a challenge, they wimped out. He says Exhibit 2 is the dissent filed in Heller by Justice Breyer, the author of today's dissent. Well, at least he's consistent. At issue in Heller was an ordinance that made it impossible for any District of Columbia resident to keep a handgun in the home for self-defense. Even the respondent who carried the gun on the job while protecting fellow facilities did not qualify. The District of Columbia law was an extreme outlier only if, you know, the name is Rahim. So nevertheless, Breyer's dissent, while accepting for the sake of argument that the Second Amendment protects the right to keep a handgun in the home, concluded, based on essentially the same test that today's dissent defends, that the district's complete ban was constitutional. Again, intellectually impossible. The dissent would conclude that the district's measure is a proportionate, not disproportionate, response to the compelling concerns that led the district to adopt it. Like that dissent in Heller, the real thrust of today's dissent is that guns are bad and that states and local jurisdictions should be free to restrict them essentially as they see fit. That argument was rejected in Heller, and while the dissent protests that it is not re-arguing Heller, it proceeds to do just that. Heller correctly recognized that the Second Amendment codifies the right of an ordinary law-abiding Americans to protect themselves from lethal violence by possessing and, if necessary, using a gun. Anyway, so let me just read that. This is the key part of it here. The dissent in Heller, the real thrust of today's dissent, that's what the three leftists said, is that guns are bad and the states and local jurisdictions should be free to restrict them essentially as they see fit. That really is the leftist argument. Pianki, go ahead.
Well, see, there we go again. And I can understand why, but this is nothing more than an example. This is an example tried for ignorant people. Mm-hmm. You're trying to give them examples and explain to them. Going back to the absolute, what the Second Amendment says, is not good enough for them. Whoever mm-hmm. heard that you have to have a license to keep a gun in your house for protection?
Well, you have a license and to then, use it and to keep it. You have to give it a license to keep it, and then it looks like you have a license to have to use it, too. So you can keep it, but you couldn't
use
it.
You got to get a license to pull the trigger. And then you have to have a license for the bullets. And then they use these old excuses about the safety of the public. Well, the safety of the public is two-sided. You got those who's going to be the criminal, then you got those who's going to be the victim. So the victim or the potential victim, the citizen, who's following the Constitution protects, should have the right, already had the right. It's not should have the right. They were given that right.
Well, the actual Second Amendment is that the government cannot infringe on that right. So the right exists. That's the thing about the Constitution. All rights pre-exist the Constitution. What the Constitution does is prohibits the government from touching them in any way or even encroaching on them. And that's something people don't understand. The Second Amendment does not give you the right to carry guns. Yeah.
All rights exist before government, period.
Exactly. You know, the right of self-defense predates the United States of America by, I don't know, humanity. Jim's on the line, too, so I'm going to get to him in just a second, but I want to get to Shirley. Your take so far. Shirley? Did I surprise you?
Hold on. I can't.
Unmute.
I can't hit the unmute button and it wouldn't go off.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Well,
I understand.
You know, I was scanning through the huge 135-page briefing, And because I'm always the one about the self-defense, and I always was amazed that you had to justify your reasons to carry. You had to show that you were in danger, your life was in danger. You don't know, unless you can look into the future and tell if someone's going to attempt to hurt you, whether you know them or not, you don't know when your life's in danger. That's why you can't, when I tell you have to justify it, that was always, just floored me. I mean, how am I supposed to justify it if I don't know if it's going to happen? And you don't know, criminals, they're just going to hit you whenever, but also people you know can all of a sudden turn and cause you physical harm as well as threaten your life. So you never know. That just always amazed me. But also I was just scanning through here, and Alito was talking about a couple of incidents where people used a firearm to defend themselves. One had to do with, when was this, 1987?
I kind of skipped over those.
Gay man in Arkansas. Yeah, and in 2020, a woman was brutally assaulted in the parking lot at a fast food restaurant. And these people, they use their firearm to save their life. So it's
Oh, no,
well,
it's fascinating.
Well, here's the thing. It doesn't make any difference as long as it's legal. You're not violating somebody's civil rights. It doesn't make any difference how you use your firearm. You may want to go along nailing wanted posters on trees like they used to use. It makes a good hammer every now and then. It doesn't make any difference how you want to use it. The Constitution says you can.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And just the justification itself is unconstitutional. No government has the right to demand of you to prove your worthiness to exercise a right. They don't do it with free speech. They don't do it with due process. They don't do it with freedom of religion. You don't have to justify your church to the government in order to practice your religion, but yet you have to justify your ability to carry a gun. What if I want to carry a gun because it looks cool? What if I really think it looks cool? And I do, actually. That's one of the reasons I want to carry a gun openly. I think it's going to look really cool, especially when I get my Western holster. This is going to be an art form, okay? That's a justification. What if I want to carry a gun because I want to live as a free man? Do I have to justify to a government what my state of freedom is? No. So any of these justifications are by themselves automatically unconstitutional. But here's the part I want to get to, and Jim's on the line too. Jim, I'm glad you called in early because this is going to be fun. But it says here the Second Circuit held that the law was constitutional, concluding, among other things, that the restriction was substantially related to the city's interest in public safety and crime prevention. And what I would say to the Second Circuit is BS. You cannot use your problems with your criminals to take away the rights of honest law-abiding citizens. There is a wall of separation between the activity of criminals and the rights of citizens. And this is what you want to start talking about, a wall of separation. The left is always talking about church and state. Let's talk about criminals and the law-abiding. Okay. If you have basically deprived yourself of rights through your actions and due process has restricted your rights, that's okay. But you cannot use that. You cannot use what criminals do to take away in any way the rights of the law-abiding or restrict them. I don't care what your public interest, your reasonable restrictions, your compelling state interest, your intermediate or strict scrutiny, none of that stuff is constitutional. It all comes down to the rights are absolute within the context of the right, which in this case is keeping and bearing, not using, keeping and bearing. Okay, this is what we're talking about. The right to keep and bear arms, the right to own and carry firearms is absolute. Now, once you start using, that's a whole different thing. Now you're under statutory law, and that certainly is not absolute, and it would be irrational to think it would be. Make sense? Everybody's quiet.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is a wonderful broadcasting. Regardless of the crime situation, regardless of the interest in public safety, of course they have an interest in public safety, but that has nothing to do with the Second Amendment.
If you want to wear your guns as earrings, you got a right to wear them as earrings. Put them on your ears.
This is kind of interesting.
If you want to go down the street butt naked and a holster wrapped around your waist and your holster tied to your thigh and your butt naked, that's your right to do that with the gun. Now, of course, they may say something about you being butt naked, but people nowadays, the way they dress, they've got 90% butt naked anyway.
You know, that's fascinating. We need a model to do a photo shoot wearing nothing but guns and holsters and gun belts. Hey, Jim, do you think is that an Amanda Supacool project, or is that a bit much for her? She has women guns in fashion. Or should we get some dude?
Yeah, I don't know that Amanda's going to make that leap, Greg.
we explore ideas on the show. Some are good, some are not. So, Jim, you called in early. Feel free to weigh in. And, of course, we got Shirley and Bianchi on the line.
I have a question.
I don't want to jump into Shirley's segment, so I'm just going to kind of listen unless you have a question for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to Shirley then.
No, actually, I'm gonna jump in with a question for Jim because, like I said, I have to run today. So, what's the impact of this? What do you see this as? How's this going to impact Florida and other states? This decision by the Supreme Court.
So it's going to have a huge implication throughout the country. I think the largest implications are going to be in the anti-gun states. Obviously, because there's a whole lot more laws there that are going to be overturned. Just on the face of the decision itself, all of the May issue regimes are now unconstitutional just based on this decision and the very clear decision that it made. I mean, it clearly stated that you cannot have a shall issue regime. I mean, a May issue regime. So all of those are immediately going to go away. I think that you're going to see a lot more laws being challenged and rechallenged in the federal courts and in the state courts based on the level of scrutiny now that this decision requires for a Supreme Court case. So now, you know, you must show that there's a historical tradition of the limitation on the rights. And based on this decision, that historical tradition is going to need to be in a very narrow period of time around the time of the ratification of the Second Amendment and or around the time of the ratification of the 14th Amendment. And you're going to have to show that there is a preponderance of the United States that had that similar limitation. So that is a very small period of time and a pretty high bar. And they've also expressly said that you can't have any kind of means-based restrictions. So
that's what we're just talking about with the public interest, the crime prevention, all that kind of stuff.
Right,
as a means
right.
Of,
without
as a justification
that,
for limiting
right,
Second
without
Amendment
having
rights,
that yeah. historical support in the record, you can't. Courts cannot any longer uphold these under intermediate scrutiny, which most have done, or interest balancing, which some have done, or even strict scrutiny, which is a very heightened standard. Even that heightened standard of strict scrutiny, the Supreme Court has now said, is not something that you can do to uphold a law that infringes upon the Second Amendment. So it's a very, very high bar. My concern with the decision, and I'll probably talk about it more later, is with the Kavanaugh concurrence that the Chief Justice joined.
We're going to get to that, absolutely, But
and he has kind of opened the door a little bit for people to run through. I think the other way that courts are going to try to get around this is they are going to ignore part of the decision that says that there has to be a preponderance of evidence, and they're going to cherry-pick laws here and there that may have existed and try to make an analog to whatever the particular anti-gun bill is. And then liberal courts are going to uphold it on that. And I think you're going to see cases rolling back into the Supreme Court because the lower circuits have proven that when it comes to the Second Amendment, they will ignore the Supreme Court's decision and make the Supreme Court make it over and over again. So, but you're going to see a lot of cases being brought and a lot re-argued. I can tell you that Florida Carry is working probably this entire weekend writing supplemental briefs to court cases that we have in process right now to incorporate this decision into our briefs to the courts.
Mm. I'll find out about that too. Shirley?
No, let's talk about that some more. I want to hear more about what Florida Carey's doing. I'm in a learning process of how all this works. So this is very educational. Jim has a lot of experience in all this. So I'm trying to understand
it gets back to the same thing. You're talking about societal norms. So if people was aware of their guns, like the absolute authorizes them to do, then where are these judgments? The court is going to ignore the Supreme. Well, people should be ignoring these unconstitutional laws. If not, there's no end to these arguments. These arguments would go out clean to a Star Trek date 3245, the way it's going.
Yeah, but the reason we comply with laws is so we don't. The only reason to comply with the laws is we don't lose our rights.
There.
Yeah, no.
The
but
court
the thing
have
is,
no reason to put these. The court has no reason, shouldn't have any authority to put these rules and regulations out there. It's simple. Yeah. It's so simple.
It is to me too, Jim.
So I agree with a lot of what Bianchi said and what you said, Greg. The reason that people don't ignore the laws is because they don't want their rights taken away, and specifically, they don't want their right to freedom taken away by a government at the barrel of a firearm that some of these courts are saying you can't possess to fight a tyrannical government. So
exactly, I mean, you lose your rights if you exercise, and the law itself that they're enforcing is wrong. But until you overturn that law, you know, they're going to use the unconstitutional laws to treat you in a further unconstitutional manner. It's not worth it.
Right.
I'm not going to carry openly until it's legal. But as soon as it's legal, I'm going to carry openly.
And to go back to, you know, Shirley's question about ways that this could directly affect people in Florida, one of the biggest ways is this has now reopened the door for us to bring a challenge to Florida's ban on open carry.
How? I want to know that connection because I think that's really important.
So the Florida State Supreme Court had ruled that using intermediate scrutiny that and it wasn't even really intermediate scrutiny. It was interest balancing hidden as intermediate scrutiny, but that's a very, very fine line that we don't need to talk about.
Well, they're
because
both
of this decision,
as far as I'm concerned, you know, you don't balance rights against. You don't balance rights. Rights exist on their own, and that's the whole point of my argument today. But anyway, go ahead. I'm curious.
So because they had made that ruling and had based it on the Florida Constitution and the Second Amendment and their interpretation of binding Supreme Court decisions, we were shut out of the state courts for bringing open carry cases. For the most part, we could still bring an open carry case regarding the carrying of long guns, and we actually have a case that is in court right now challenging the open carry of long guns in Florida. But we were barred. It was settled law in Florida that we could not bring a case about the ban on the open carry of handguns. But because it was decided under intermediate scrutiny, and the Supreme Court has now said that neither intermediate nor strict scrutiny is appropriate for trying a Second Amendment case and deciding a Second Amendment case.
Yep.
That decision was improperly rendered, and now the courts are back open to us. And we now have a much more conservative, much more pro-gun Supreme Court in the state of Florida. So,
well, that helps.
So you can... You can expect sometime in the near future those challenges will be coming back up. And we're hoping that it will be the case with the long guns challenging, because now we will be able to amend that based on this decision, to include handguns in that decision as well.
You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of an auto mechanic. Got your car up on the rack. Instead of looking for trouble, he's looking for things that's working right so he can loosen the bolt so it starts leaking. That means you come back next week. Then he loosened enough. It means you come back next week. Come back next week. Come back next week. That's what they're doing. Until you say, hell no, it's unconstitution, they're going to have you coming back, coming back, coming back.
I can't disagree with that at all. I mean, that's exactly what happens.
Now you know why Pianki is on the show, just for his insights. You know, Pianki, you're like Will Rogers, okay? You're still like the Will Rogers of action radio. You know, you just take a situation and reduce it to the absolute essence when you said that the Constitution doesn't have an on and off switch. I can't tell you how many times I've used that. So I love your commentary. Let me, I found something in some of the better quotes from this thing as I was trying to scramble it. We're talking about this whole idea of balancing of rights. I think this was Justice Thomas who said, in the last decade of Second Amendment litigation has taught this court anything, it is that federal courts tasked with making such difficult empirical judgments regarding firearm regulations under the banner of intermediate scrutiny often defer to the determinations of legislatures. But while that judicial deference to legislative interest balancing is understandable and elsewhere appropriate, it is not deference that the Constitution demands here. The Second Amendment is the very product of an interest balancing by the people, and it surely elevates above all other interests the right of law-abiding, responsible citizens to use arms for self-defense. So basically, right there, he tells us you can't do it. This isn't a question of interest balancing. This is a question of constitutional rights, and constitutional rights are supreme over any alleged interest balancing. So that can't be used as a justification for eliminating the Second Amendment, because nothing can. That's how I see it. Anyway, that's why I like that quote. Panel? Who wants to jump in?
Greg, Shirley. I would...
Go ahead.
Let's take Shirley, because she's got to go soon.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, Shirley.
No, I just... Who defines what intermediate scrutiny is? How does, you know, you can cut this down to how do you define that? Who defines that? What's, you know what I mean?
I do. This is a Jim question. Jim?
Yeah, any level of scrutiny is defined by the adjudicator or the judge or jury. In this case, it's typically a judge because it's being decided in an appellate court. In intermediate scrutiny, the judge has to find first that the state has a compelling interest that is causing them to act. In the case of firearms, the compelling interest is almost always expressed as a concern for the safety of citizens. And every court that I know of has always accepted that as the compelling interest. So the second half of that under intermediate scrutiny is that the law which has been proposed, which infringes on the right, must be directly related to that compelling interest. So as long as it's directly related to making people safe under intermediate scrutiny, then the courts will uphold it. Under strict scrutiny, it has to be not only directly related to, but it also has to be the least restrictive means of achieving that goal. And so strict scrutiny is much more difficult.
But they're both wrong, though. They're both wrong. None of these scrutinies apply to the Second Amendment because the compelling state interest is that the right is protected. That's the compelling state interest. So the idea that the state can take away a right to allegedly address a crime problem, those two are completely unrelated. The state protects the right, but in protecting the right, they actually address the crime problem. So they're doing it backwards. This compelling state interest is a bogus test. It doesn't exist under the Constitution. It is, as far as I'm concerned, illegal because it violates the Constitution while supposedly trying to protect it when it's doing just the opposite. Pianki?
Well, and Greg, I would say, you know, the quote that you just gave a few minutes ago, I think what you just stated is summed up really well in the very next sentence in the opinion.
Okay.
Where Justice Thomas said, it is this balance struck by the tradition of the American people that demands our unqualified deference. So right there, he's saying you must defer to the plain language and the history of the Second Amendment. You can't go any farther than that. There is no other level of scrutiny that you can look at.
No, I agree to
he's
the point, but the problem
right.
is he is right, but the whole point is the Second Amendment doesn't have to be justified by history. It doesn't matter exactly what they said back then and what they thought and what they believed and what the practice was. What matters is what the Constitution says. And what the Constitution says is that the right of the people to keep and bear arms can't be touched. The right of the people to own and carry firearms can't be touched. And no test, no scrutiny, no reasonable restriction, no compelling state interest, none of that stuff matters. That's the problem I have with this decision. So, Jim, when we talked before about this, the good news and the bad news, how far are they going to go? They went only as far as they had to protect the right, but they made all these different steps, especially frat boy Kavanaugh, who really screwed things up. Because they said, well, it doesn't cover this. It doesn't cover restrictions on who can own a gun. It doesn't cover licensing. It doesn't cover all this other stuff. When, in fact, every one of those things they said this decision doesn't cover is another infringement of the Second Amendment. And that's where they screwed up. They had the chance to fix everything, and they blew it again. That's my point. Even though they did some good things here by affirming the right that
what
we already had anyway.
On,
we didn't need their opinion. Yeah, go ahead, Bianchi.
What you got going on is lawyers that want to be paid infinity arguing these fruitless – putting these fruitless arguments up there. You know what the people with DC carry? You need to start carrying spears. Get you some spears and just walk around with them. And given any given amount of time, they'll come up with a reason why you shouldn't be doing that.
Wait a minute, that's racist. You got black people carrying spears. You're going to run into problems there in DC. I'm sorry, Pianchi. So someone's going to say it's politically incorrect. It's going to happen.
Why complicate something so simple? Because there's a monetary benefit from it. Be scrutinized and this, that, and the other is nothing more than a bunch of bullcrap. Like Clarence Thomas said, it's plain. It's plain as a bell. What is so different? You know, if you was making a Thanksgiving turkey, it would come out looking like barbecue ribs by the time you get through with this scrutinization. Leave it alone. Go back to the basics. Put the switch back on.
Yeah. Shirley's left us, unfortunately. She had a limited time. She has to go teach a lesson. So, Jim, we have lots of time because Derek's not here. So if you have any extra time, we can hash this out further. And I got Clarence Thomas' decision and a bunch of quotes and things like that. But let's get to Pianchi's point, which is the same as mine, that they're messing with stuff they don't have to mess with. They're going through all these mental gyrations, based on Supreme Court precedent and, the history of the different cases. None of that stuff really matters if they simply dealt with the Second Amendment. They wouldn't have any of these problems. Jim?
So two parts. The first part, going back to what Pianchi said, I like what you said. However, I really like ribs. So if they were trying to make a turkey and it came out as barbecued ribs, I'd probably
That'd be
happy.
A good thing.
But that's just me. On the other side, Greg, it goes back to the discussion we had on the last show. When you say that the Second Amendment means what it says and unqualified meaning of what it says, I go back to that's not what you really mean. Because you don't really mean that you want felons to carry firearms. You don't really mean that you want the mentally ill to carry firearms. None of those are in the Second Amendment.
Well, let me talk about due process again.
Right,
okay,
but now when you go to due process mm-hmm. by definition involves the courts. So uh-huh. now there must
well, that's
be
fine.
Something instructive for the courts. You can't just say it means what it means and leave it at that, because the word due process does not appear in the Second Amendment. The word felon does not appear in the Second Amendment. The word mentally
right,
ill does not
apply.
Appear in the Second Amendment.
Right, right. But see, the Second Amendment's absolute within its context, and its context is the right of people who have not been denied rights through due process, the right of people to own and carry firearms.
But that's not
the
what
government
it says. It
cannot
say,
touch.
But it doesn't say people who have not been denied the rights of due process.
Well, it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to.
Why doesn't it have to?
Because it's talking about the right. So you see, you're bringing the right to people and the exercise of the right as opposed to the right itself. If you take
let me ask you this then. If that's the path we're going to go down and say that's what the Constitution means,
right.
does that mean then that the government may deny someone their right to practice a religion because they're a convicted felon.
No.
No, they can't do that.
But I don't think. But I don't think gun rights can be denied once a felon's out of prison either, because if you have either you get your rights back or you don't. So in other words, if someone is out of jail, if they're a danger to society, they're a danger to society. They shouldn't be out. If they're not a danger to society, then they get all their rights back. You can't just give some rights back and make it conditional.
Okay, we can go with that, and I could agree with that. Now, what do you do with the mentally ill?
The mentally ill comes under due process once again. But you're see the thing is you're confusing.
But again, then,
you're merging two issues. Hold on.
Let me continue with my analogy though.
Okay,
so the mentally
free.
Ill, you're saying as long as they've had due process, they can be denied their Second Amendment right. Is that correct?
What I'm saying is that mental health issues and criminal issues are separate issues to the Second Amendment. If you just take the Second Amendment by itself, the right, not how it's applied, not individual people, but the right itself of the people to keep and bear arms can't be touched. Now, if
well,
you want, as we all know, okay, wait a minute. As we all
here's
know,
the thing on
that,
mental.
Go ahead, Bianca.
Here's the thing on mental illness. What kind of mental illness? Because mental illness carry a lot of categories. From at one time, the American Psychiatric Society had homosexuality as a mental illness. Smoking marijuana as a mental illness. Have lingering effects on past occurrences, like people always talking about slavery. Is that a mental illness?
Well, they say gun ownership. The
so
CDC said gun ownership
is a mental
illness.
It should be classified. What kind of mental illness are you talking about? You got a mental illness where you want to go around and stab people? So no, we've taken it too far. We keep you coming up with these alternative reasons. And when a felon gets out and has served his time, he should be able to afford it the Second Amendment, 100%.
I can get on board with that. Now let's go to the mental illness side. Someone who is dangerously mentally ill, someone who has lost touch with reality, should that person be allowed to own a firearm and possess a firearm?
We got to determine that first, because what if your ex says you're dangerously mentally ill?
But
you know?
It's absolute, it doesn't matter, Greg, because you said it's absolute. So,
no, I said the right is absolute. The right is absolute, but the ability of everybody to exercise it is not. That's what I'm saying.
Then it's not absolute.
So,
it
sure
doesn't
it.
Mean what it says if there are
yes,
categories that you can restrict, because now you've just opened the door for liberals
to
invent whatever category they want.
No, because mental health is separate from the Second Amendment. Criminal activity is separate from the Second Amendment. If it were not, then you could limit the Second Amendment because the state has an interest in preventing crime. But you can't say that because the Second Amendment is absolute. Now, whether the city or the state limits crime is up to them and the procedures they take to do it, but they can do whatever they want as long as they don't limit, as long as they don't infringe upon the right of people to keep and own and carry firearms.
I will tell you, if you say
you're not seeing my separation.
If you say that they're absolutely, if you say that they're absolutely separate, that is a dangerous path for you to go down.
Because?
And here's why. If you say that they're separate, and saying that they're separate means that you can bar felons from possessing firearms, there is nothing in the Constitution then which would prevent them from moving that to misdemeanor crimes. And you can't now invoke the Second Amendment because you said they're separate. Crime and the Second Amendment aren't related. They're completely separate. You've also opened the door to what Bianchi was said earlier, where non-dangerous things that have been qualified as mental illness now can bar you from possessing firearms. That's a very dangerous place to be.
No, I didn't say mental illness could prevent you. I'm saying that everybody's entitled to due process. You're confusing the issues. You know,
how am I confusing the issue? Let's say you require due process, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've already said that the Second Amendment is completely separate from mental illness. So now my due process is simply I have to prove you're mentally ill. If there is a very minor condition that is considered a mental illness, I can now say you are mentally ill.
Yeah, what you're doing is kind of muddy in the water. Under normal circumstances, under societal norm, majority of the population is not at the point of mental illness where they're going to harm somebody as we're trying to put into play. Now, you have to have, it's just like these red flag laws, where a person that has been called in on, they should be afforded the right of due process to show that this call in is not legitimate.
I will agree with that 100%. Now it's not absolute anymore.
It is absolute.
If it's absolute, there's no such thing as a red flag law. There can't.
That's not true either.
Well, it has to be a red flag law, just like it's got to be a red stop sign. I mean, you can travel wherever you want to until that stop sign says you need to stop so that you don't get yourself into a whole lot of trouble.
I mean, we could debate this all day. And we could debate it all day, but my point remains, if your contention is that the Second Amendment is absolute and says what it says, and mental health illness and criminal activity are completely separate from it, then you are in a dangerous place because
No, it's not. I'll tell you why.
Unless your opinion is Greg Penglis gets to decide what is or is not.
No, not at all.
At some point, a court has to decide. And a court is going to make a judgment. And you've already said the Second Amendment has nothing to do with it. So they can't look at the Second Amendment to provide guidance.
You're confusing the issue, Jim, because let's take it to the individual level. All right, go ahead, Bianca, and then I'll put my bit in.
No, what I'm saying is this. If the person is being claimed to be mentally ill, he's the one who has the right to due process to say, no, I am not mentally ill.
Okay, you're right.
That has nothing to do with the Second Amendment.
Okay, you're right. Now let's take that a step further. As you've said, there's a lot of things that the American Psychiatric Institute says is a mental illness. Are you okay then with anyone who has any of those conditions being prevented from owning and possessing a firearm? Because they can be proven mentally ill under the definitions that exist right now.
Oh, everybody can.
Smoking marijuana, I don't think smoking marijuana has anything to do
there's the problem. As you just said, I don't believe. And someone has to make the decision. Because everyone has a different idea of what they believe is or is not.
That's where the person that's being claimed don't have the mental capacity because they smoke marijuana, or because they have hallucination, because they hear bells in their head. That's where they have to be given due process to show that, no, this won't stop me from being afforded my Second Amendment rights.
You can't bring the Second Amendment in. Greg's already said they're completely separate. Second Amendment doesn't apply.
Well, that's what you're trying to do, say that they don't have a right to own a weapon. So do they have a right to drive a car?
But Greg has said they're separate. They're not related. You can't invoke the Second Amendment into mental illness or crime.
Well,
completely
Greg has
you have
a right
an absolute
to amend.
Right unless.
Greg has a right to amend his previous statement, too.
I just have to get into this debate.
Okay, go ahead, Greg.
It's pretty simple. It's pretty simple because the Second Amendment applies to everybody, okay? The Second Amendment is absolute. We have an absolute right to keep and bear, okay? That does not include use, obviously. And if there are individuals that, if given due process, say somebody puts on their Facebook, you know, I'm going to go shoot school X, okay? That is evidence that they need to be investigated. They need to be and probably limited and possibly, you know, for making threats like that, you know, arrested. I'm not sure what the charge is. But anyway, those are not folks. They have by their own actions, have given themselves a due process and taken themselves out of the right. Okay. So that to me is a different situation, but you've got to treat it individually and you've got to apply it. So can the courts look at that? Sure. that's a mental health issue. That's not a Second Amendment issue. In other words, you can't say because someone threatened a school that you can take away, that, that you can then place limits on everybody on the Second Amendment. See, here's where it gets confusing. This is why the Second Amendment is absolute, but there are individuals in the application of different laws, mental health laws and criminal laws, that change things for those individuals. If an individual robs a bank and then says, well, I was just exercising my Second Amendment right, well, that's preposterous, okay? Because Second Amendment doesn't include use and criminal laws apply. The Second Amendment is limited to keeping and bearing, okay? That's where it's absolute. So once you get into these other issues of how everybody can be, you know, mental health is individual, criminal law is individual, and those things can't be used to limit the absolute right in the Second Amendment that people have the right to keep and bear arms, but individuals by their actions and through due process may not be able to because of what they've done. Not
okay,
because
so
of prior restraint. That's the difference.
Here's the other point. The other point is that why are you taking away my Second Amendment protection because this person is mentally ill? Do I have not the right to be able to protect myself with what I choose to protect myself with? Because that person you claim is mentally ill and he may or she may do harm to me.
So
that's where the problem comes in.
And I agree with that 100%, Pianki, but that I don't think is what we're debating now. We're debating the individuals now. So, Greg, then if someone is severely mentally ill and has not committed a crime, it is your opinion that they have an absolute right to keep and bear arms, no matter the severity of their mental illness.
Well, but see,
they have a right
that.
To use
you
the
have
Second
to determine
Amendment
that
as an argument.
They do until you determine otherwise, absolutely, because you can't do prior restraint. You can't arrest people for what you think they might do.
How,
you cannot guess at whether somebody is mentally ill or not, because what you're doing, yes, you know, well, are there people who might be mentally ill who might be, you know, have access to firearms? Sure. But that's the price of freedom in society, you know, because the greater evil is taking away the rights of everybody else because of this imagined person that has, you know, problems. And so this is why we have a Second Amendment, so that we can keep and bear arms, so that we can defend ourselves against those exceptions that haven't shown up in the background checks, that haven't shown up in the criminal things, that haven't committed their first offense yet. That's why we have, you know, the Second Amendment being absolute, so we can all keep and bear arms, so that the state isn't taking away our rights to defend ourselves against that mentally ill person that hasn't been determined mentally ill yet. So in that respect, the Second Amendment is still absolute.
But I'm not talking about someone who hasn't been determined. I'm talking about someone who hasn't committed a crime.
Okay.
So let's say you have someone who is a schizophrenic. Severe schizophrenic.
Right.
A severe paranoid schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
Never committed a crime, but they are severely paranoid schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
And what way?
Are they working? Are they existing in society? Are they taking public transit? Are they paying mortgages? Do they have a job? Are they paying taxes? What are we talking about?
Whether they're doing those things or not, I don't know that that matters because you're still a person.
Yes, it does because if they got a mortgage, they got a house.
Let me finish. Greg
they got a right to protect that home.
But Greg said you can't take this away based on prior restraint. So this person has not committed a crime.
Right.
So whether they own a house or take public transportation doesn't matter. They have not committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Can this person, if they have due process,
right,
be adjudicated to be mentally ill and be prevented from keeping and bearing arms under
understanding? Which mental illnesses, let's get back to Bianchi's point, which mental illnesses disqualify you and which ones don't?
Yeah, which
does
mental
depression
illness?
Does depression disqualify you? I was depressed for a couple of years. You know,
okay,
did that disqualify
so,
me from keeping my guns? No, I didn't sell them. I kept them. Kept them locked up.
My first question, we'll get to that, Greg. My first question is there any mental illness which can, under due process, disqualify you in your idea of how this works, that can disqualify you from owning and possessing a firearm if you have not yet committed a crime?
Well, let me ask the same
thing.
Yeah,
if you already went out and tried to kill
someone. Can you possess a hammer? Can you possess a car? Can you possess drain cleaner? Can you possess a chainsaw? All
right.
Of these are lethal implements. So is it firearms you're limiting, or are you limiting dangerous objects? See, this is the question. See, they always limit the firearm, but they give the sit. No one says anything about mentally ill people keeping other dangerous and lethal implements.
Okay,
around.
So that's a separate question. But getting back to
not.
The firearm,
no, it's not. It's exactly the question. Go ahead.
So in your opinion, then let me make sure that I understand what you're saying. Because
don't restate my opinion.
You've now introduced something completely different. So I want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying.
Okay.
What you're saying is there is no mental illness so severe that absent criminal activity, you cannot be.
I didn't say that at all. I didn't say anything of the kind.
That's the question I asked, though. And then you
hear
different examples. My question is very, very specific.
See, now what I'm saying is what I've said. If you want to ask me a question on what I think, that's a different thing.
And then, how long do the mental illness last?
And that's another question. I mean, the bar could be temporary or permanent.
Jim, right. In all due respect, you disregard the questions that need to be answered to answer the one you continually want to reside on.
Well, Pianchi, okay, we can do that, but I'm trying to get what Greg's position is. If you want to get mine, I can give you mine. I can tell you what my position is, and I can answer all those questions.
I haven't
fully unwrapped what Greg's position is because
you disagree with my position. That's perfectly fine. My position is very clear.
I don't understand your position, Greg.
Well, let me tell you again.
My problem is I don't understand it because there is a very specific question I have about it that I can't get you to answer because you keep changing what the question is.
No, I don't. All right, go ahead. Ask your question.
Okay, here's the question. Is there any mental illness so severe that you believe absent commission of a crime, a person may be denied their Second Amendment rights with due process?
I have no idea. The answer, the reason, that's a good question. I have no idea because I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I will say, though, that if you're going to deny a Second Amendment right, there has to be a due process. And part of that includes a mental health evaluation. If you can determine through the normal due process, investigation, search warrants, observation, all the mental health laws, if you're going to determine that. But here's the question, though, too. You're assuming that mental illness, includes violent behavior. There's a lot of mental illnesses that don't include violent behavior. So what you're really still dealing with is mental illness. You're not dealing with the Second Amendment because the Second Amendment's absolute. The right of the people to keep and bear arms can't be touched by government and cannot be infringed upon, okay? So the right of the people, okay? Now, individuals in the individual application of mental health laws and arresting people for committing crimes is something different. You cannot have prior restraint. You cannot arrest people for what you think they might do. You cannot seize their property for what you think they might do. That's not how a free society works. Now, does that mean that people might be out there who might be able to commit that first offense that we don't know about? They're going to sneak out of nowhere and do it? Yes. That's why we have a Second Amendment. That's why it has to be absolute, so that we protect the right of individuals to defend themselves against that mentally ill, that criminal, that person who is not on the books yet, that doesn't have a record, that's committing that first offense or whatever, that we didn't know about. That's why we have a Second Amendment. That's why it's absolute. So the idea of the state with some kind of compelling state interest in preventing crime is going to take away our rights to prevent crimes upon us as individuals. That's wrong. And that's why the compelling state interest is unconstitutional.
The reasonable restrictions are
unconstitutional. All these things, using mental health to take away the rights of the people, using mental health to take away the rights of the people is wrong because the Second Amendment's absolute. Now, if you want to deal with individuals,
and when you talk about a person with mental illness, you're talking about a person. You want to apply laws to the people that should be applied to that particular person that's undergoing those particular instances.
Exactly.
Pianchi, hold on. When have I ever said that I want to apply laws that are meant for a person to apply to the people? Because
Let me explain to you. See, here's the thing. You got politicians, because of something that a person done, then they want to deny that right of the Second Amendment to the entire people. It happens all the time. Sheila Jackson Lee got problems in her 5th district there in Houston. She wants laws that should apply to them. She wants to apply to me who lives in Missouri, per se. That's wrong.
Okay, but I don't think, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe Greg can tell me or you can tell me where I'm wrong, where have I tried to do that, where I've tried to apply this law to the people rather than a person?
Well, when you're saying that a person that's a felon, well, everybody's not a felon. This applies just to that felon. If that felon or that mentally ill person is deemed to be a danger, then for the period of time that they need to, that they are deemed to be a danger, well, they should be restricted to something. They shouldn't maybe be driving. They maybe shouldn't be having alcohol. They shouldn't have a knife, a gun. It's only during that time. It's not a lifetime ban. I don't think it should be.
Okay. So if we go down that route, and we can go down that right, who gets to decide how long that ban is?
A doctor. That's due process, right?
Well, if it's due process, a court decides. If a doctor decides, that's something different. But in any case, someone is deciding.
No, the court don't. The court's going to bring in specialists.
Right.
Having access to the court in order to get to that decision by people who are trained to know, they have to use the court. They can't just have it at any old corner store.
Right. Okay. Okay. So you bring in the experts, which will disagree, and eventually a court decides. But now we're getting into something that Greg said he doesn't want, because now courts are deciding who can and cannot possess firearms.
Did I say I didn't want that?
Well, I think Greg is putting more emphasis on the absolute than anything else.
Well, Greg, you did because say as soon as the felon was released, they should have their Second Amendment rights back. So if you have a period of time that they can't have them, Second Amendment is not absolute anymore.
Why they say
they should have.
It's just like, me and Greg.
What? Go ahead.
I and Greg can't fly if we've drunk alcohol within the last 8 hours. It took them away my right to fly. Am I right? Is that the time period, Greg, 8 hours?
Or still under the influence, so a hangover would count too. So you can't have within 8 hours, nor can you be under the influence, regardless of the time.
So the rules have taken away my right to fly. But after that period is over, I can go back to flying.
One would argue that we don't have a right to fly, but I would, but that's a separate conversation.
Right.
Now,
but
here's
okay,
the thing,
Greg. So go back to your thing where you said.
So
that,
let's
that
see. I think you're not getting the separation of the right itself from the application of laws to individuals. And this is something I really tried to make clear: the right of the people. And this is why I said it like three times: the right of the people to keep and bear arms can't be touched. In other words, the government cannot make any kind of conditional restrictions of any kind on the people to keep and bear arms. That includes how we carry them, includes the ones that we purchase, if it's commercially available. Now, if the government determines that a certain firearm is particularly dangerous because it goes full auto, you know, the minute you touch the trigger, and it's not supposed to do that, then that's a problem. Then that gun is unsafe. That can be regulated. Okay, that's not part of the Second Amendment. But the right to keep and bear arms touched. Now, having said that, you know, when it comes to individual behavior and when you get below the constitutional level into statutory law in terms of uses, that's a different thing. So the problem with mental illness, the problem I have with mental illness is it's being used as this blanket thing to take away rights from the people. And this is where it gets to be a problem. So if the right is absolute, you're going to start taking away from an individual. That's different than taking away from rights from the people. And so the difference is the right is absolute for the people, but individuals, given due process, obviously rights can be deprived with due process. That's what jail is. Jail is the ultimate deprivation. Well, actually, capital punishment is the ultimate deprivation of all rights. Okay? Which you couldn't be able to do capital punishment if all rights were absolute for everybody, regardless of anything else. So to say that's kind of crazy. So I think you're distorting my argument. All right? And so if you consider mental illness, but we get into this wild world because this is new. We never used to have this back, 20, 30, 40 years ago. No one said we need to limit everybody's rights because of mental illness we probably know more about it now. But the question is that being used against the right or is it being used against individuals? If it's being used against the right, then it's wrong because the right is absolute. If it's being used against individuals who we have determined through due process, not only can't own firearms, but can't exist in society, that's a different thing. So what I would say is if you're going to deprive someone of firearms, you better deprive them of everything else too,
because you can't deprive somebody of firearms, because then it becomes discriminatory. Because what you're saying is we're going to deprive people of their right to firearms, but we're going to let them have chainsaws and cars and drain cleaner and knives, you know, and hunting knives and all these other things out there. Okay, so if somebody's violent, they're violent. If they have a mental illness that makes them violent, that's on them. That has nothing to do with the Second Amendment, because you can be violent with any number of different objects. You can be violent with your bare hands. You can sneak up on somebody in a subway line and push them onto the tracks with no weapons used whatsoever. Okay? That's an individual. That's a person who obviously is mentally ill. All right?
Yeah.
But it has nothing to do with the right to own and carry
firearms. In front of cars.
Exactly. People do horrible things to people all the time. Okay?
Right.
Now, do we make laws against cars? Do we make laws against subways? Do we make laws against all these other kinds of things? No. Do we keep everybody off the freeway so nobody drives drunk? Well, if you keep every car off the freeway, yeah, you're going to stop drunk drivers, but you're going to stop everybody else too. Okay. Do you stop people from using bank accounts because people rob banks? No. Okay. So in the same way, if somebody's mentally ill, they're mentally ill. Then if you're going to judge them as mentally ill, you know, and a danger to society, they're just as dangerous with a chainsaw, with a knife, with a vehicle, with any sharp object as they are with a gun. Therefore, but if you go after only the gun, then you're discriminatory. Then you're saying that we want to deprive somebody of their guns, and that's a political question. That's not a legal question. That's
you know
a political
what it reminds
agenda
me of,
question, and that's what it comes down to. That's
you
why
know
the right
another
is absolute.
Example. You know what another example is? Sobriety checkpoints. Why in the hell do I have to go through this line? I never have drunk in my life. Why are you making me go through this line and asking me these questions, asking me to count count from 90 backwards and stand on one foot and walk? Why are you making me go through this? I don't drink.
Well, those
so
are
Pianchi,
illegal.
I,
those are unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Just
I
as random drug
tests. I agree with you, Pianchi. I disagree with Greg's part about saying they're unconstitutional because you
sure
don't have a constitutional right to drive.
Ooh, do you want to talk about that sometime?
Now,
you
may say
you
that
do.
You have a natural right to drive,
uh-huh.
but you don't have a
well,
constitutional
no.
right to drive.
In the Constitution? No, but the Supreme Court, believe it or not, I'm actually going to cite them, have declared a right to travel. And what is driving if not traveling? Do you want to talk about that next week?
Well, yeah, they get you for – wait a minute. You got some municipalities that say walking while drunk. And they haven't got to riding horses while drunk, but I imagine they would come back with that also.
They probably had that. Those laws might be gone by now. But it's a great question. It's a great question. Do you have a right to drive? I would say yes. I would say these artificial laws and these rulings by courts that said that driving is a privilege is incompatible with a free society. Because if you have the only way to exist in a free society, or one of the ways to exist in a free society, is the freedom of mobility. That's like requiring everybody to have an electric car and then shutting off the power so people can't drive. That's a restriction. I believe we have a right to travel. Now, it's not enumerated in the Constitution because nobody thought it had to be because it was never a problem until now. But here's the question. Ever since the advent of the car, did they license horses? Did you have to, you know, was riding a horse a privilege? No, it was a necessity. But nobody questioned it back then. But I believe that the driver's license is illegal. To be licensed by the state to travel is an illegal usurpation of our rights.
Okay, Greg. Now,
let's take
that to the next step then. Licensing mm-hmm. pilots then is illegal.
Interesting question. I'd have to think about that, and I'll tell you why. Because the ability – because flying requires a much higher level of skill. And so, yeah, I'm going to have to think. I know what you're going to say. Do
now
you have
a
right a to fly?
Based test?
Well, here's the question, though. Do you have a right to fly? I would say in the same way. Now, here's another question, though. Is a driving test legal? I would say demonstrating your skills to operate on the road is probably something that's okay. Just as demonstrating your skills to operate an airplane is okay. The government came up with criteria. I quite honestly don't want everybody hopping into an airplane and flying. Hell, the people that are trained are bad enough. You know, the private pilots that are trained. Badly are bad enough, you know, but that's a separate issue. So the question is, do we have, I would say, yes, we do have a right to fly. However,
16-year-old
you can
fly.
Be tested in your competence. So in other words, if you want to replace a driver's license with a test of competence, a certificate of competence,
That'd be an interesting question. So you demonstrate your ability to drive. Now the same, but then it gets to firearms. Do you have to demonstrate your ability to own a firearm to use a firearm in order to buy one? And so far, society has said no. Gets interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, one has to be, and one has to show their ability and be certified to fly by instrument rather than visual.
Mm-hmm. And there's a good reason for that, because if you don't have instrument training, you're going to die. Trust me, I've trained enough instrument pilots. They all
so you're okay with a driver's license as long as it's called a driver's license.
No, I'm not.
As long as it's called
a certificate
of competence.
Test of competence.
Isn't that what a driver's license is, though?
Well, see, what is a driver's license for? Because you can enforce all the traffic rules and laws, the stop signs, the speed checks, you know, the speed limits. And things. You can enforce every driving law there is without a driver's license. You don't need a driver's license to enforce driving laws. So what is the purpose of a driver's license?
I would contend that it's to show your competency, but you tell me what you think.
But you don't need a license to show your competency. You just need to show your competency. All right.
Okay. How do you do that?
That's a good question.
How do you demonstrate that you've shown competency
by
driving on the road?
By not breaking the traffic laws.
Okay. Then why can't you do the same thing in an aircraft?
That's a good question.
Why do we need to pre-license and pre-certify airline pilots? Mm-hmm. Why can't you just fly? And if you fly illegally, there's no prior restraint. You fly until you do something illegal, and then you're punished for it.
Yeah. I think I need to think on this because it's a good question. And I think that the damage, you know, you look at the damage that can be done by an airplane in the hands of a reckless person.
You're
huge.
Greg, you're dangerously getting into what anti-gun people say about firearms.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I've already defended that argument.
One should know the rules and regulations of the road. Like you can't take, and I've seen this before, by the way, someone who come from a country where they drive on the opposite side of the road in a different direction, they ended up on the side of the road going toward incoming traffic. But just like it is with guns, there should be gun safety classes too to make sure that you can effectively and safely handle a weapon.
Well, you know, one of the big things with cars is insurance. And so, you know, you're not going to get insurance. You know, you may have insurance companies actually giving tests. So, okay, we're going to insure you, but we want to see how you drive first. And we'll base your insurance on how you drive. You know, there's something to be interesting. With flying, you know, there's flying insurance. I don't know the question of that because as someone who trained pilots, I know that it takes a high level of skill. Jim, I know you've trained people for different things. It takes a high level of skill to do certain jobs. So the question is, do you have a right but still have a compliance factor? That's a great question. I think for driving, the skills are a lot less than for operating an airplane. So I do think we have a right to travel.
Yes, sure.
So the
question is, what is the minimum age for flying, about 14?
I soloed at 16, but I started lessons at 12.
Yeah, I think I've seen kids at 12 years old certify with general aviation, then turn around and certify with helicopter rating.
No, you can't know. The youngest is 14. You can fly a glider at 14, but to fly a powered plane, you have to be 16 to solo, and you have to be 17 to get a private license. It's interesting. You can fly an airplane at 17, but you can't buy a gun.
And I think flying a glider is harder than...
When I think about this, you can fly a glider at 14, but you can't buy a gun until you're 21, 7 years later. Figure that one out.
Well, we'll see what happens with that based on the new Supreme Court decision, because I think it's going to be difficult for the states to show a historical example of where someone over the age of 18 was prohibited from owning and bearing firearms in the time around the ratification of the Second and 14th Amendments.
Yeah. See, the historical perspective has always bothered me, because what if people 100 years from now say, well, wait a minute, the historical perspective is the Sullivan Laws. For over 100 years, you know, you couldn't carry a gun outside your home in New York. So that's historical. You know, the Clinton illegal gun ban, you know, the semi-auto ban that lasted for 10 years was historical. And the Supreme Court never overturned it.
So the Supreme Court, though, I think they looked forward to that. Thomas did an excellent job, and he said, it is not a blanket historical record. You can't look at laws from the Middle Ages. You can't look at the laws from the 1900s. Mm-hmm. You have to look at what was the historical examples of what was and wasn't allowed at the time of the ratifications of the amendments that are implicated here. And that's
yeah,
the
see,
Second
that's
Amendment
though.
And the 14th Amendment. So those are the two time periods that you have to look at to understand what the rights meant when those amendments were ratified.
Yeah,
so
see,
Sullivan
laws
are out the window.
Yeah, I know that, but I don't care what the rights meant at that time. I care what says, what the Constitution says now. I guess that makes me a textualist over an originalist. But the point is, it matters what's there now. You know, because in the same way, you could say, well, if we're going to go back to the historical record, in history, they only had muskets. So if, the,
okay,
if it
but,
meant...
But he,
you know,
he dealt with that also because he
okay,
said, and he discussed that and said, like with other rights, like the First Amendment, it is not strictly those items there. You can take direct analogs from one period to another. So if an AR-15 is an analog of the musket, then obviously the framers believe that AR-15s are something that you could own and possess.
Okay.
And so
yeah.
he actually did a very good job of that. It will still be bastardized, I'm sure, by liberal courts.
Yeah.
But Thomas actually did a very, very good job of giving a framework that can be used. I would have liked for him to gone farther. I don't think he could have gone any farther. One of the other interesting
Well, they're still
things
limited by their that, decisions. They're still limited by Heller and McDonald, which I think is crazy. Because those decisions, they talk about reasonable restrictions and limitations on the Second Amendment. And as I've said, the Second Amendment's absolute. So those things are moot anyway. So to use those cases with those flaws in them to bolster this case, to me, seems a huge mistake.
Yeah, but the limitations that were outlined in Heller and McDonald were very, very small.
For now. You know, who's to say what the next court will do?
Well, but... Yeah, I mean, but that's, you know, if you're going to argue about Heller and McDonald, you know, the restrictions that Heller and McDonald said were reasonable based on history were felons, sensitive places such as schools and courthouses, and I forget, those were the two big ones that I remember.
You see, I disagree with this whole idea that that public buildings are off limits to firearms. You know, you should be able to carry in a police station. You should be able to carry in government buildings. You should be able to carry in post offices. That's crazy. What is this special right that government buildings have that we lose our defense rights in government buildings? That's nuts. The only exception I would think of is in an actual courtroom because of the issues and stress. And that's something that, you know, hey, I'm willing to debate that. But as far as government buildings in general, no. Why can't you bring a gun to the DMV? What, you're getting your license? You're doing some paperwork?
So in Florida, you actually can.
Okay, well, that's good. I didn't know
that. Yeah, public buildings are not prohibited places in Florida.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. So, and if you see a sign on one of those public places, please let me know.
Okay, I will.
What you got here is that we've put too much power into these courts as well as government. People should just wear their guns, that they're, in fact, send a message. Where are you then?
Yeah, normalizing. Yeah. Well, and just to give Jim a compliment here, I mean, the reason it's so much fun debating Jim, even when we disagree, is he's so well-informed. He knows the issues. He knows the score case better than I do. You know, and I was involved heavily with our doctor's debate yesterday, trying to come up with a judge that's going to overturn the emergency use authorization. So I cover a lot of issues. This is why I have specialty reporters on that know in excruciating detail all these things. So, Jim, thanks for a great debate. We're not done yet. I'm sure we're going to continue this. But it's just nice to have you have be so well-versed in this particular decision so quickly, considering it just came out yesterday. So I appreciate that.
And I appreciate it, and I always love the debates with you because you make me think about things that I haven't thought about. But I do want to give you a very interesting little historical tidbit that I think you'll love, Greg.
What's that?
So, and I'm going to show how terrible I am at predicting what the Supreme Court will do. I'm gonna give you a historical tidbit and talk about how terrible I am at predicting what the Supreme Court's gonna do. So before yesterday, I had predicted a couple of things about this case. The first one was I predicted that it would be handed down on the very last day of the Supreme Court session.
Right.
This
when
year.
Is that? This October sometime, isn't it? Or when is the last
no,
day?
No, 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 no. It will be either next week or early in July. So there are,
okay.
I think, 9 cases left to be decided.
That's
Monday
when they start
is
the, that's when they start then in October. Okay.
Right. They'll
yeah,
start
ahead.
Again in October. So they
okay.
And they typically save these large blockbuster cases that have huge public interest and that fundamentally change kind of how the legal system works for the last
yeah.
day.
Yeah,
they
so
did
they
not do
Malta
that on this.
And hide. And, like,
which is why I
town.
Still think right, which is why I still think you'll see Dobbs handed down on the very last day, whenever that very last day is, whether it's
that's,
next
that's
week or right after the 4th of July.
Yeah. That's what you wait for those who don't know. Okay. Yeah,
right.
Go ahead.
So I was dead ass wrong on that.
Well, that's okay. Well, that's not that big a
now,
deal,
the,
Jim, because
the,
you figure what, you're off by a week or two?
Kind of, so
you're only off by a week or two.
Right.
So it's not a big
but
deal.
But still,
yeah.
I was wrong. But the
fine.
Historical kind of tidbit that you'll really enjoy – and I don't know if this factored into the decision or not, but a very important thing about yesterday, in addition to being the day that this case was handed down, it was also Justice Thomas's birthday.
Yeah, I saw that. I got a post on that, too. I got a big grin
so
of him coming out.
So he was
of,
allowed to
yeah.
hand down this seminal Second Amendment decision on his birthday.
Happy
again,
birthday
no
to
idea
you.
Whether
Happy birthday
those two
to you.
Had anything
Happy
to
birthday,
do with each
Justice
other, but
Thomas.
I thought it was interesting.
Stay to you.
And the other thing I was dead wrong on is I predicted that if the Chief Justice were in the majority on the opinion, that he would write a very watered-down decision himself and kick this can down the road. And I almost never ever say anything good about the current Chief Justice.
Well, that's because there isn't anything good to say.
In this
pretty
case,
boy GQ.
I,
yeah,
in
he
this
works
case,
more on his,
I will
yeah.
I will say something good about the Chief Justice. The fact
okay.
that he gave this opinion to Thomas to write, I think
was it
was
birthday present?
Incredibly
present?
Impressive. Maybe it was, and if it was, I wish that Thomas would have more birthdays each year. But
exactly.
Thomas was probably the perfect person to write this decision, and I think it was a great decision on the Chief Justice's part to have Thomas write it instead of writing it himself.
So why do you think
now?
Do you think he didn't want the opposition? He didn't want the criticism? He didn't want his pretty boy image ruined? His GQ modeling appointments canceled?
So
why do you think he did it?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I think one of them is that he did not want to write a divisive opinion.
Okay.
Because he is very concerned with how he's going to be viewed in the future.
Oh, no
and
kidding.
So he's hedging his bets that no matter which way the court goes, you know, he won't be vilified in the future. And I don't think that's a good place for the Chief Justice to be, but it is what
well, he
is.
Didn't write a concurring opinion either. That's not only did he give
well, that,
to Clarence Thomas. Everybody, just about everybody else wrote a, Justice Thomas wrote the opinion. The concurring opinions were Alito, Frapboy Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. That's 4 people. So I don't know who
yep.
didn't, who else didn't do it. So who are we missing?
Did not.
Gorsuch. Oh, so Gorsuch didn't say anything. So he's the only person that voted for it and didn't have an opinion, as well as Roberts. I found that interesting.
So interestingly, what I found even more interesting is Roberts did have an opinion because Roberts joined Kavanaugh's concurring opinion in addition to joining the majority
oh, yeah, you're
opinion.
Right. Yep, I got it right here. Yeah. Kavanaugh sucks. What's his problem? What is it with Frat Boy? Why
yeah,
did he shut the hell up?
Well, I thought sorry, that it was interesting that the Chief Justice – actually let a very junior justice write a concurring opinion that he agreed with rather than writing it himself.
Ooh.
And again,
whoa.
I think that is so that he can hide behind Kavanaugh's opinion rather than having someone go, look at what you wrote. These are your words.
Right. Well, can you name any great opinion that Chief Justice Roberts has actually written?
No. So that
maybe
was an
that's
easy
the problem.
Yeah,
can
that was
he
an
write?
Easy one.
Can
I,
he write?
I mean, I guess you
do
could look at some unanimous opinion that he may have written that you could say, okay, that was okay.
Well,
I can't
up.
Think of a tough decision that has been handed down, that he wrote what I would consider a very good or great opinion. Now, I think the other reason that he gave this opinion to Thomas is I don't think that there's anyone on the current court who understands the Second Amendment as well as Justice Thomas does. I will say that Justice Alito is a very close second, but I would still put him behind Thomas in understanding the Second Amendment, the history of the Second Amendment, and the history of jurisprudence around the Second Amendment.
I was just looking up opinions by Chief Justice Roberts. Apparently there's a lot of them.
Yes.
You know, but I don't know any of them that are actually noteworthy.
And that they try to balance as best they can the number of opinions that are written each year by justices. So they actually try very hard to ensure that there's at least some close equity among the number of opinions written by each justice each year. It becomes difficult when you have a court like we have now, because getting a lot of opinions for the more liberal justices becomes a bigger challenge, because they're not in the majority very often. So what you end up happening is the liberal justices tend to write most of the unanimous opinions of the court so that they can get their opinion numbers in.
Yeah, but look at the liberal, look at the opinion, look at the dissent of Breyer. You know, and this is why I read Alito's critique of it, you know, in the beginning of the show. It is basically an emotional talking point, unrelated crime statistic, you know, typical gun-grabbing agenda thing that has nothing to do with the Second Amendment and nothing to do with the issue before the court. And yet they call that their opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wish that Justice Alito, in his, you know, scathing rebuke to the dissent, would have included in there something about the fact that, you know, after the Jonestown massacre with Reverend Jim Jones, we didn't suddenly infringe on the First Amendment right to religious freedom.
Yeah.
So claiming that just because there is a mass killing compels you to do something to violate the Constitution, it's not what we do with other constitutional rights, and the Second Amendment should not be a second-class right.
Well, that's a big point, too. In fact, I was going to get to probably the last hour. I don't know how much time you have, but, you know, Justice Thomas's decision, I was kind of going to go through it. You've actually gone through some of the major points, which is great. You know, so I still want to maybe get to some of that stuff, Pianki, and I will hash it through after I play a bit of stuff. But, yeah, the things that they left out, too, are pretty amazing. But before you – I don't know – how much time do you have? 3, 4, 5 minutes, 10 minutes? What do you
– Yeah, I probably got – somewhere between 5 and 10 more minutes.
Okay, so let's talk about Kavanaugh. What is his purpose here? He says, I join the court's opinion and I write separately to underscore two important points about the limits of the court's decision. So he's focusing on the limits rather than the actual, you know, the good things that are in there. He says, first, the court's decision does not prohibit states from imposing licensing requirements for carrying a handgun for self-defense. Well, those licensing requirements themselves are unconstitutional. Getting back to my basic argument, okay, the ability of the people to keep and bear arms, you know, is absolute. You can't restrict that. And then he says, in particular, the court's decision does not affect the existing licensing regimes known as shall-issue regimes that are employed in 43 states. So he's justifying, you know, the fact that these things exist as justification for their existence. So they're already here, so they can stay here. Why didn't the court look into licensing requirements of shall-issue? Why didn't they go full constitutional carry? Why did they specifically point out that we're not touching other things that we should be touching? That's my question.
So my answer, and this is just my own intuition from looking at the court and kind of the history, is that Kavanaugh and Roberts have signaled to people who are filing cases, do not file a case saying that the only way of having your right to the Second Amendment is constitutional carry, and don't file a case saying that licensure is unconstitutional because you will lose, because we have two people on this concurring opinion who are telling you that they are constitutional. So if you take those two and add them to the five liberal justices who dissented, you have a majority. So they are signaling
three.
To
so it'd be five
I mean, to
four.
The three. Yeah, you have. Yeah. Yeah, you have. I'm sorry, those two and the three. Okay. So right. You have a 5-4. So I think they are signaling, do not challenge the actual license scheme because you will lose. And I think, if I remember correctly, that Kavanaugh also talked about limitations on places that you can carry in his concurring opinion.
Well, let's go through a little bit of it. It says the court's decision addresses only the unusual discretionary licensing schemes known as may issue regimes that are employed by six states. Okay, you're absolutely right. So this is a great revelation. As he's talking about a great insight, he says that we're not talking about the usual ones. So the usual restrictions on the Second Amendment are okay. It's just the unusual ones that are not okay. Well, that what kind of legal standard is that? He's making up stuff too.
Yeah, he is making up stuff.
Yeah, I agree that I think that what he said is absolutely incorrect. And I also think that that is a signal to all of the people who are getting ready to bring litigation to say, unless you want an opinion from this court that you're not going to want to live with, don't bring one of these cases, because the two of us are going to join the liberals and give you a decision that you don't want.
Yeah.
And I disagree with it 100%.
Yeah.
What he's saying too is states have a right to regulate abortions.
Well, I think that you're going to see that next week. Yeah, I think you'll see that next week.
Huh. Okay. Well, it seems like he goes out of his way to limit the Second Amendment in ways that never had to be done. He's talking about here. There's one thing. Where's that thing in Black's Law Dictionary that said the Second Amendment? You know, I'll see if I can find that quote. I've got it in my stuff here. Is it? Because I disagree with this completely. Where did I put it? It's up here. I can't find it. This is maddening. But basically, there's a law quote that they're going by, Black's Law Dictionary from back, 100, 200 years ago, saying that you know, the Second Amendment does not mean you can, own anything, carry anything, or use for any purpose. And my disagreement was, you can own anything, you can carry anything, but no, you can't use it for any purpose, because purpose is outside the Second Amendment. So they're using, again, they say two things that are true and one thing that's false, saying that all of them are true. And that's that kind of legal rationalizing is what drives me crazy.
If someone's coming after me with a knife after I fought them out and they're still coming, the only thing I've got there is a cannon. I'm going to load that bad boy up and fire it on. Hit it right in the gut with the ball. Right, saying okay. You can't do that?
Well, here's what he's saying. This is weird. He says, as Heller and McDonald established, this is Kavanaugh talking, as Heller and McDonald established, and the court again today explains, the Second Amendment is neither a regulatory straitjacket, which of course it is, which is not, nor a regulatory blank check, which of course it is. He says, properly interpreted, see, this is why the Supreme Court can't interpret. This whole idea of interpreting the Constitution is nonsense. They have to read it. Anyway, it says, properly interpreted, the Second Amendment allows a variety of gun regulations. Well, that in itself is just, that's unconstitutional, obviously. Then he says, Heller, as Justice Scalia wrote in his opinion for the court in Heller, and Justice Alito reiterated in relevant parts in the principal opinion of McDonald, like most rights, this is the quote, like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. That's not true. That's what Jim and I have been arguing all morning long. It's an absolute right. Oh, here's the quote. From Blackstone through the 19th century cases, commentators and courts routinely explain that the right was not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever for any purpose. Okay, and then I just said I disagree with that. You can carry any weapon whatsoever, and you can carry it any way you want, but of course you can't use it for any purpose because use is outside the Second Amendment. Okay, and then he says nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt. Yeah, go ahead.
The court's interpretation should only be on laws, not the Constitution, but laws.
Well,
does this law go against the Constitution?
Well,
I interpret it that it does.
should it be judges or juries? I think juries should sit. Should
well,
get
sometimes
into it with
you
law
are
law.
Between the panel of, in front of a panel of judges.
Yeah.
I mean, they should.
Well, here's
know.
What he says too. Here's part of the other decision. He says, nothing in our opinion should be taken, this is what Jim was mentioning earlier, nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, excuse me, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. Well, none of that's true. You know, the as we argued before, those things are outside the Second Amendment. You can't. This routine prohibition in government buildings is crazy. This blanket, you know, felons and the mentally ill, you know, if you designate somebody as such, can't own firearms when they can own chainsaws, is crazy. And the whole idea of sensitive places, well, where are the mass shootings taking place? Sensitive places, schools, churches, all the places they say are sensitive, you know, those are the gun-free zones, victim disarmament zones. That's where these crimes are taking place. So designating an area as sensitive actually is designating that area as a target. So what the hell is he talking about? This is why I don't like these limitations, these so-called limitations. They try and justify limitations, say, well, it's reasonable and constitutional, but it's really not because it creates all these other conditions and sets up crimes.
Yeah, I agree with you. The sensitive places I wish would not have been in there. And I think that's another signal that they're sending out is be very judicious in which law against sensitive places you try to challenge under the Second Amendment, because again, there are two people who are going to tend to uphold them. I think the other thing that he's doing here, although he hasn't mentioned it specifically, is I think he's also signaling that you should not put in a challenge to the National Firearms Act. Which,
see, that's interesting, because
if,
it needs to be challenged.
Right. And if you take Thomas's opinion of the court, I think it is right to challenge the National Firearms Act, because there is nothing in the historical record which would prevent you from owning, for example, a short barrel rifle. There is nothing
fully
in the
automatic
record. Which
a fully automatic firearm
you, right,
is
fully
is
automatic
legal.
Firearms. Right. There is nothing that would preclude those. And I think this is Kavanaugh and Roberts saying, be very careful about what you send, because if you send this up, we are liable to rule against you and you're going to have the binding precedent.
That's interesting, because one of the things we talk about, we have a bill that not only calls for tax credits and deductions for the purchase of firearms, you know, so that everybody can exercise their rights, particularly low-income people. We have another act that would take suppressors and silencers off the National Firearms Act so people don't go deaf just because they're trying to defend themselves. And so that would be a perfect challenge to the National Firearms Act would be suppressors. There's an example of something that we need guns to be noisy so we can hear gunshots. Oh, please. People are going deaf trying to defend themselves. It's nuts. Pianchi.
Here's an example of a Miller case. Armed man who wanted to kill Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh told police he was upset over abortion Uvalde. Now, this guy has got a mental problem. He
but
shouldn't
he's also
have
demonstrated
a gun.
It, too. He's demonstrated that problem, too, by committing a crime. You know, he attempted an assassination of a Supreme Court justice. He should be in jail for the rest of his life, but not have any rights. But it's demonstrated. You know, he wasn't arrested the day before he did it. He was arrested when he did it. That's the difference. Pianchi, did you have more on that? Yeah. Okay.
That's pretty good.
Well, thank you. Jim, what do you think? Especially, you know, as someone in law enforcement, is there any reason that we can't have suppressors or silencers? I guess they're called suppressors now on our firearms so that we don't go deaf in the process of defending ourselves and other people.
I don't know of any reason why suppressors should be considered illegal. They probably should never have been included in the National Firearms Act in the first place. The problem we have with suppressors really is a Hollywood problem.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because in movies, when someone puts a suppressor on a firearm, it is almost impossible to hear.
But that's not how they work, though.
Right, and that's typically not the case.
Well, do they suppress enough to remove enough of the damaging noise above a certain decibel level that, yeah, it's still going to be loud, but it's not going to do the damage it would without the suppressor?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
In fact, in many countries in the world, you are required to hunt with a suppressed rifle.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's not
too loud
for
the deer
protection, but it's also to not disturb people who might be in the area.
Well, yeah. See, I think we should have camping and hunting in different areas. Call me crazy. It seems to me that's not a good mix.
And there are actually some firing ranges around the world that require you to have suppressed weapons if you're going to shoot in a firing range.
Now, do they reduce the velocity extremely? Is there a reason other than the noise to not have one?
No, they have a slight effect on velocity. The effect on velocity is not significant. It is significant enough that at distance you would have to re-zero your weapon if you want to take accurate shots.
Are we talking 100 yards, 500 yards? Where are we starting to see a problem?
It depends on how accurate you're looking to be.
Oh, okay.
And it depends on the firearm and the round that you're shooting. It has some effect. And some suppressors have more effect than other suppressors.
See, but that's not the problem, though. Outside rifle shots aren't the problem. I mean, you can still wear, a noise-canceling headset and still hear other sounds. So that's not the issue. I'm talking about inside your home or inside a car. You're being carjacked. Yeah. Are you going to go deaf because you blast the .357 inside your car and you got permanent hearing damage? How many law enforcement officers, this is never really talked about much, but how many law enforcement officers are out on disability because they use their weapon properly and yet still went deaf or had hearing damage where they could not continue on the job?
Yeah, I'm sure it's a huge number. I mean, I tell people all the time, if you have to use a firearm in self-defense, prepare yourself that you will, at the bare minimum, have temporary hearing loss.
Right.
You may have permanent hearing loss, but at the bare minimum, you are going to have temporary hearing loss.
And that's all guns. There's not a gun. There's not even a .22 has damaging sound.
And the other thing to think about with rifles, when you talk about rifles, is you can suppress the sound of the cartridge being fired and the round leaving the barrel. But once that round goes supersonic, you are still going to have the crack of the sonic boom when that round becomes supersonic. So no matter what you do at the rifle, you're still going to hear that loud crack when the round goes supersonic, no matter how much you suppress, unless you slow it down enough that it's no longer supersonic.
Subsonic. Yeah, I remember when I used to do 1,000-yard rifle competitions, and I'd load my own, and it was quite an interesting practice, long-range shooting. But we had to serve in the pit, and we had one of these pits where it was dug out, and of course you put the target up, and the people shoot it, and the bullet cracks overhead. But even at 1,000 yards, you can still hear some of these bullets are still supersonic, and you can't miss that sound. It's a unique sound to hear, and you never forget it. It's like, oh, that's a bullet crack over my head. Okay, got it. And so, people don't realize, all these little things because they're not gun people, but it's quite fascinating. But that's not the problem. Like I say, the reason for a silencer or a suppressor, are there really silencers anymore, or is that a misnomer? Should they all be called suppressors?
I prefer suppressor because none of them make any round silent.
Right.
Silencer was kind of an interesting
Hollywood
thing. and it was just a kind of a common colloquial thing that people could say. They made it more silent, so it was a silencer. It actually suppresses the sound. There are very few rounds that become very quiet when shot through a suppressor. A .22 that is subsonic will be very quiet if it's shot through a suppressor. A subsonic 300 blackout round will be very quiet when it's fired through a suppressor. I can't think of many other rounds. Some handgun rounds that are subsonic will be very quiet when fired through a suppressor. But for the most part, it makes it so that it's loud but not damaging to your hearing.
Yeah. See, I think that's what most people want. You know, if we could do that, and that just, you want to talk about a common sense gun law? There's a common sense gun law. You know, not having people have to make the decision to lose their hearing to save their life. Because now the rest of your life, you've already compromised the rest of your life because of what some criminal is doing. And that to me is a deprivation. All right, I want to take a break for a bit here, and I want to just bring up totally different subjects. I think we've covered this pretty well. But any conclusions, Jim and then Pianki, and of course, Jim, we want your contact information. Conclusions. First of all, Jim, thank you very much. This has been fabulous. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And no, I mean, it was a great day for the Second Amendment. It could have been better. You know, I could have lived without Kavanaugh's concurring opinion.
yeah. Or your warning.
But
thanks.
Absent that, it was a great day for the Second Amendment. And I heard liberal heads exploding all around the country. And that always makes me happy. Yeah.
Let's give a cheer.
Right.
Thank you, Thomas and Alito. The rest of you,
yeah. and Gorsuch. I mean, Gorsuch didn't join the concurring opinion. Barrett didn't join
true.
The concurring opinion. So
yeah, thanks for not saying anything, Gorsuch. Yeah, you did the right thing.
But I always have thought that Gorsuch was more pro Second Amendment than Kavanaugh was. Kavanaugh was always kind of the wild card for me. On the conservative side of the court. So,
well, he never should have been on the court. Did you ever see that video I did on the seven most important minutes of the Kavanaugh hearing where Lindsey Graham, who actually did something right, absolutely grilled him on Roe v. Wade. And he said, what is the limit on your creation of rights? And Kavanaugh said, well, in the Supreme Court, we don't have any limit on the creation of rights. And then he said, well if Congress wants to dispute one of your constitutional decisions, what do they need? Well, they need a constitutional amendment. Well, that's insane. And yeah, that's what came out. So I have no use for Kavanaugh. I mean, I just as soon have whoever else is supposed to be on the court. And Amy Coney Barrett's not really thrilling me much either. Gorsuch is okay for now, but the Three Stooges, they're not really distinguishing themselves at this point in terms of proper judicial constitutional activism like Alito and Thomas have done.
Well, I mean, while that's true, you know, they're also very young. You know, at 1 year in, like Barrett is right now, mm-hmm. I don't think you could say a whole lot about Thomas being a distinguished jurist at his 1 year mark.
Okay.
And
yeah,
and especially
true.
Thomas, because Thomas doesn't speak typically during oral arguments. So
yeah, we wondered where he was the first 20 years.
Yeah.
We knew he was there, but he wasn't. But he wrote some good opinions. He just wasn't talking,
right.
Which is kind of crazy.
And I kind of like that. I wish more of the justices would do that, because what you end up having in the Supreme Court now is instead of the lawyers arguing the case and presenting their side, you have justices who are going in with preformed opinions, making the arguments for the lawyers, and that should not be the role of a judge or a justice. They should listen to the sides presented and then judge based on what's been presented.
Well, what if they didn't
Thomas
judge
never
what's not been presented?
Right, because he had Thomas has a Gullah accent. Because he's from the Gullah Geechee down in the Carolinas, and people used to tease him about that. So it was a carry-on is what it was.
So did he work hard to get rid of his accent and make it more neutral, like every broadcaster in the South does?
Well, I don't know. I guess he did, but I don't know.
Because I have no problem with the way he speaks. I've never heard anything that was hard to understand. In fact, it was kind of a shock when I first heard him and when I started listening to some of the Supreme Court testimony. But to Jim's point, you raised an interesting question. Should they be limited to what's presented, or should they be able to bring in their own experience, reading, research, things like that? I don't want them specifically limited, because what if the lawyers suck on your side and they're not bringing in arguments that they should?
It's not that I don't think they should be able to bring in their own research on the issues.
Right. Uh-huh.
I don't think during oral arguments they should be making cases for either side.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
I think they should listen to what's presented, mm-hmm. and then when they go in and they make their decision, as they do now, they should go and do their research and pull the information from past opinions and from history and all of those things that they do now. I just don't like justices watching their preferred lawyer floundering and then stepping in and becoming the de facto lawyer presenting the case.
Yeah, I think you probably guess that's happening more on the left. I remember, was it either Kagan or Sotomayor that said we have to have the vaccine mandate because COVID's killed a million people. Well, I would say a lot of them were killed by, you know, government policy. So that's not an argument. But the thing is, they bring in sideline arguments. They bring in the talking points. You know, we have to, you know, have the Sullivan Law because there's crime out there. Well, they have nothing to do with each other. One's concerning the Second Amendment. The other's concerning crime. So they bring in these sideline issues and use that. But that's the left does that in everything. They'll take one issue, bring in something that's not related or enough unrelated things that it looks like some of them are related and use that as an argument against something when, in fact, they have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah, I would contend that the right-leaning justices do it as well. They may not do it quite as much as those on the left, but other than Thomas, who tends not to speak, although during COVID he did, I think those on the right do it as they do it also. I won't say they do it as much, but they do it also. They, when they see their side floundering, they tend to jump in and try to rescue him by framing a question in a way that presents an argument and then asking a question that goes around what they just used as their argument.
Yeah. I want to let you go unless you can stick around for
several
minutes.
No, I do have to go. Yeah.
Okay, fine. Let's get your contact stuff, and I want to bring up a completely different issue. I think we've really covered this well, and I want to thank everybody for participating. So, Jim, how do people reach you, and what can they tell you about the cases we're going to bring to the Florida Supreme Court now that this case has gone through?
So, Jim Dykes, Director of Florida Carry. You can reach Florida Carry at FloridaCarry.org on the web. You can reach me directly, jim@FloridaCarry.org by email. And all I can tell you is stay tuned for the cases that are coming. We are in meetings this weekend and probably all of next week to talk about what our next steps are going to be. But you can expect a number of cases being filed and amended within the Florida courts from Florida Carry. So
yay. Well, that's going to be fun. Yeah. Like I say, I'm already starting to look at my Western holster for my various firearms, you know, modern firearms and old holsters. It's going to be great. Bianchi, go ahead.
Yeah, Jim, wear your weapon and be safe.
Thanks, Bianchi. You do the same.
All right. Let's get to Federalist number 12, and hopefully I can get Anti-Federalist number 12 over this weekend. I got a Matt Gaetz meeting and some other things going on, but we'll see. Anyway, back in a little bit, taking a break. Bianchi, I'll mute you so you can make noise. And after this presentation and a couple things, we have a fabulous article by Emeril Robinson, my newest favorite, who talks about how the Republicans are really trying to lose the midterms. And this may shock a few people, which is why I like the article. Back in a bit. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Even the title of Federalist Number 12 is bad. The utility of the Union in respect to revenue. First of all, the Union was not created for Alexander Hamilton, who wrote Federalist Number 12, to rule it, nor was the Union created for his utility, nor for the Union to generate revenue. Hamilton says, "The prosperity of commerce is now perceived and acknowledged by all enlightened statesmen to be the most useful as well as the most productive source of national wealth, and has accordingly become a primary object of their political cares." Such grand assumptions. All enlightened statesmen? So those who disagree must be stupid by comparison. Commerce is supposed to bring wealth. That's why we engage in it. But commerce is for private wealth, entrepreneurial wealth, investor wealth, and more. It is not for governed national wealth unless the commerce is nationalized. Maybe that's what Hamilton had in mind when he talked about commerce becoming, quote, a primary object of their political cares. Hamilton and the Federalists appear to believe that not only the Constitution and and the federal government should serve elitists like himself, but the commerce of the nation should also. I can see why the anti-federalists were so popular and why people are encouraged by government to study only the Federalist Papers. Consider this paragraph. The ability of a country to pay taxes must always be proportioned in a great degree to the quantity of money in circulation and to the celerity with which it circulates. Commerce, contributing to both these objects, must of necessity render the payment of taxes easier and facilitate the requisite supplies to the treasury. In other words, don't tax more than a certain portion of the money supply so taxes flow in easily. So the goal here is to tax not on the necessary expenditures of government, but on how great a proportion the federal government can tax to facilitate the supplies of money to the treasury most easily. It's also interesting that Hamilton does not trust the states at all regarding commerce or anything else, which is ironic because it's the states that delegate all power to the federal government through the Constitution. But Hamilton is so contemptuous of the states. He thinks their purpose is to conspire to commit commerce in a way the federal government could not tax. Again, according to Hamilton, like people, businesses are to serve the federal government. He says, the relative situation of these states, the number of rivers with which they are intersected, and of bays that wash their shores, the facility of communication in every direction, the affinity of language and manners, the familiar habits of intercourse, all these are circumstances that would conspire to render an illicit trade between them a matter of little difficulty, and would ensure frequent evasions of the commercial regulations of each other. Stating things not at all in evidence, that they are in fact evident, Hamilton once again claims that only a national, not federal, national, as in a top-down supremacist government, can be trusted to collect the taxes and keep the treasury full. Whereas the states, which are sovereign entities, will break into confederacies and ruin all Hamilton's plans to run the economy with the national government. He concludes, it is therefore evident that one national government would be able, at much less expense, to extend the duties on imports beyond comparison further than would be practicable to the states separately or to any partial confederacies. The only thing that is evident to me is that Alexander Hamilton wants a strong national government so his fellow elitists can control the economy and put away money in the treasury based on how much money they can get away with putting in the treasury and use for their own purposes. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Panglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.
Yeah, you probably heard me playing around with the volumes a little bit there. I'll decide which one's the right way to go. So let's bring back Pianki, and let's get on to some different things here. Yeah, I think we pretty much covered that that Supreme Court case in excruciating detail, which was good. You know, it's done. We've got every possible angle, and Jim brings up some interesting points to debate. But you and I seem to agree, you know, far more than we disagree on pretty much everything, which is very interesting. Any other comments on that case?
Yeah, but it's clear as a bell. It's absolute.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that's a different concept. People, yeah.
I wonder why some people like to argue, throw out these scenarios in order to get one up on the other one coming from the other person. I don't know. It's simple. It's absolute.
No, It's a common debate thing, and then, you know, and with all respect for Jim, which I really do, but I will, you know, disagree with one tactic when anybody says, "So what you're saying is," so in other words, let me rephrase what you said to fit my argument, you know, and I said, "Well, what I said was what I said," you know, if you interpret what I said, that's one thing. If you want to challenge what I said, that's something else too. But if you're restating what I said in a way that I didn't say it, now you're changing the argument. And so that's why it's always dangerous to do that, because it doesn't apply. And trying to say, well, what you're saying is, well, if this is what you say, then this, you know, and those things don't necessarily follow. And that was the point I was trying to make with Jim. But I make that point with everybody, because this is a very common way that people engage in arguments. And I disagree with it, because I think you're misstating and not dealing with what's said. You're dealing with what, you know, you want said, so that you can change it into something else. And again, nothing away from Jim. I mean, it was a good argument he was making,
it does
challenge. But just the method that technique of so what you're saying is, you know, and if it's really absolute, then
I don't have anything against him. Yeah. I think that they need to hear people say things a different way. Mm-hmm. And I get tired of always having to wait in suspense to see what the hell the Supreme Court is going to say, or what these courts are going to say. People need to take that back, Greg. They've slowly eroded your ability to assert what's yours. Mm-hmm. And you gave it away and let them come out with explanations of why you can and why you can't. That's a bunch of bullcrap.
Yeah, well, this is the reason I don't put a lot of stock in the Supreme Court opinions. First of all, they're opinions, not decisions. And secondly, because I don't need the Supreme Court to tell me I have a Second Amendment right that's absolute. I know I have that right. So this weird, you know, preponderance of people that needs a validation. So in other words, the Constitution says the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Until the Supreme Court says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed? No. You know, the Supreme Court said to take decisions that challenge that. So what the Supreme Court did in this case was right, where they said this law, you know, has violated the Second Amendment because it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms doesn't exist. You know, you need a license.
Well,
we're not going to need a license. You know, so that
it's funny It's funny how some people who proclaim to be religious and Christians, they say that the word of God is irrefutable. but they can't say that with the U.S. Constitution. It has to happen. Yeah, so let's do the same, apply the same reasoning with the Bible. When it said, thou shalt not kill, then let's put that up for judgment.
Well, you know, if the Bible is irrefutable, why are there four Gospels?
Four Gospels that nobody know who wrote.
Well, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If the Bible is irrefutable, that means they must all say the same thing. If what they said was absolute, then you wouldn't have four Gospels. I should ask Wendy that question.
Well, that's in the New that's in the Apocryphal, which means books of no known authorship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's the missing Gospel of Thomas. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, let's change subjects a little bit here, because this we could endlessly debate. The Supreme Court did things pretty well right, but they really left themselves open for further abuse later on. I think Jim's absolutely right when he says that there is a signal that Kavanaugh and Roberts are saying, don't challenge the usual decisions that are infringing on the Second Amendment, only challenge the unusual decisions that are infringing on the Second Amendment. So in other words, they're saying which infringements are legal, which is what they can't do because they're not reading this Constitution, because it is absolute, as we have said over and over again. The right of the people is absolute, but individuals, through due process, their actions can be limited, and that's the difference. We limit criminals all the time. They get the due process, and then then lose their rights.
Go what they've done is regulated our constitutional protections to prior decisions, mm-hmm. which is wrong.
No, there's no prior restraint. Prior restraint's unconstitutional. You can't arrest people or seize property for what you think they might do. You can't. What if they do? That's a tragedy. That's an illegal action, so that we have to have the means to defend ourselves. That's my argument against it.
There stands a stop sign. Either you mm-hmm. didn't stop for it or you did. It's simple.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Why make it so hard?
You know, either we have the right to own and carry the firearms of our choice the way we choose to carry them, or we don't. That's an absolute. All right. I found this article I think you're going to find interesting. Emerald Robinson, my newest favorite journalist. I'd love to get her on the show. I've written her syndicate, Substack, whatever it's called. No luck. I tried. I guess I have to pay for a subscription maybe. Anyway, she was on Newsmax. She was on One American News. She's absolutely gorgeous, and she's completely brilliant. You know, so I definitely want to love to sit down and chat with her or get her on the show so we can talk. Anyway, she says the GOP wants to lose the midterms. The GOP establishment sold out its own voters once again before the 2022 elections. Well, we've talked about that before. The Republicans won the 2018 midterms. The House is actually Republican. But the geldings let the Democrats overturn 7 seats in California, giving majority illegally to the Democrats. But everything that the House has done the last 2 years has been illegal because they actually won. They won in 2020, actually since 2018, so the last 4 years. So they won in 2018, they won in 2020. They let the Democrats overturn the election. They give the power to the House. The Mitch McConnell gives the power to the Democrats in the Senate, even though they're split equally. Kamala Harris doesn't have a vote in the Senate until there's a tie. Until then, they should have co-chairs of the committees. But he doesn't do that because he's a gelding. Anyway, so I agree with Emma Robinson in this article. She says, when did the GOP cease to be a functioning party? When was the exact moment that you knew the GOP establishment stands for nothing and stands against nothing? This is why I call them the gelding old party. Okay, there's a reason for this. She says this week brought yet another example of the GOP's complete ideological collapse. The Senate just passed an unconstitutional red flag gun control bill last night with the help of 14 GOP senators. And they did so while Democrat activists were still illegally harassing Supreme Court justices at their private homes. They did so 1 week after a Democrat activist tried to assassinate Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh at his private residence. They did so while the GOP's chief pansy, Mitch McConnell, was still complaining that Democrats refused to pass legislation for extra security to protect Supreme Court justices. What greater signal could the GOP establishment send that it has no interest in defending the lives of its own judges, let alone its own voters? Isn't this good? I'll continue. Texas Senator John Cornyn was the lead GOP negotiator on this gun rights control bill, and he pushed the legislation against the wishes of his own party and his own constituents, as he discovered at the Texas GOP convention last week. Yeah, he was booed. Booed by everybody. It was amazing. Article says Senator Cornyn pushed the bill anyway, which means he doesn't care about his constituents. He also dismissed the Texas GOP as a mob in a private conversation, which is proof that Cornyn has become, for all intents and purposes, a Democrat, which is why I now call the RINOs transgender Democrats. So it seems like we're kind of in the line here. It's very interesting. She says the corrupt corporate media hailed the gun control bill as a, quote, bipartisan effort, and that's exactly what Republicans passing Democrat legislation always call their capitulations. Cornyn was joined in his treachery by the GOP's usual gang of losers, Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, Lisa Murkowski, Rob Portman, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Bill Cassidy, Tom Tillis, as well as more recent failures like Todd Young, Roy Blunt, Richard Burr, Shelby Moore, Capito, and Joni Ernst. Ask yourself, why would 14 Republican senators sell out the Second Amendment rights of their own voters just before a widely predicted red wave arrives this November? Well, let me ask you that question, Bianchi. Why would they do that? Why would they sell everybody? Why do you think?
I don't know. Maybe they got something to gain from it.
Well, that's the question. Here's the other one. Why would the GOP establishment surrender to Democrats over the single most important issue for their own party right before a midterm election that could put them back in control of the House and Senate? So why would 14 Republican senators, and where is Mitch McConnell saying, don't you dare vote for this gun control bill, this gun rights control bill? We're going to deny you election funds. That's what he could say, but he won't because he's gilding. Because he supports this. He supports the Democrat agenda. Because most Republicans support the Democrat agenda.
Yeah,
the
Lindsey Graham they're there, voted for it too.
What's that?
Lindsey Graham was on board. He's one of the 14. And then it gets back to the same old thing. People let these Congress people get away with what they want to get away with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, now Florida could stand up and say, we're not going to do this. Now, Florida said something interesting. Actually, one of our grocery stores, Publix, has declared they are not going to give the jab, the COVID snake oil death shot to children 5 and under. They're not going to do it. I wish they wouldn't do it at all. I don't like the idea of grocery stores dispensing medicine. You know, to me, it's like practicing without a license.
You got to be kidding me. You go to the store to get a loaf of bread and a bottle of milk and get a shot.
Yeah. Well, they have like Walmart drugstores and things like that. They have shot. They have, I think Walmart. What's the drugstore I'm trying to think of?
Walgreens. I don't like Walmart because they banning Mr. Pillow products in their store.
Yeah. What are those called again?
Huh?
Oh, that they don't want. They don't want Mike Lindell's
Mr. Pillow. Mr. Pillow.
Yeah. Screw them.
Yeah, he's complaining about the 2020 election. They want to ban his products in their stores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, crazy. Just because he's telling the truth, he gets his products banned. Fascinating. What they're doing is they're deciding they're becoming election officials. So Walmart is not responsible for being an election official. They can't rule on things like that simply because they may not like it anyway. But it's just here's what it says. Here's what she says, and this is continuing on. The answer is obvious. The answer to those questions, why would they do this? The GOP establishment has no interest in being the ruling party. I agree. I've always thought they were losers. I thought they're more comfortable being losers. They give away victories, to the Democrats so they can be losers. When Republicans win, they make sure that they get those elections overturned so they can be losers. They want to be losers. John McCain was given the nomination so he would lose to Barack Obama. Mitt Romney was given the nomination so he would lose to Barack Obama. Jeb Bush was going to get the nomination so he would lose to Hillary Clinton. I mean, losing is what the party does. That's why, I've registered Republican only so I can vote in the primary. But the day after the primary election, I'm going to go back to being independent. Screw them. But there's so many Republicans on my ballot here, it's kind of stupid not to do it. But I have no use for the party. And quite frankly, they have no use for me because they're losers. And I'm not going to be in a party of losers. A bunch of gelding.
Well, you can solve that. You can solve that by limiting their power to print money, like you said many times.
Oh, no. That's a bill. You want to talk? Let me bring that up here. So I'm going to send this to Matt Gaetz again because he's got some rally in Pensacola this Tuesday. But this is my favorite new bill. And so let me bring it up here. So you go to writeyourlaws.com. I'll tell everybody where to find it. Writeyourlaws.com, WriteYourLaws.com, writeyourlaws.com. You go to legislation and you click the first one, propose a new law. That's where you write your bills. Citizen bill ideas is where that's our workshop. That's where we work on bills and all proposed laws. That's where we put our bills when they're ready to go and we're ready to send them to the various legislatures. So my favorite new bill, constitutional amendment. Congress shall not have the power to borrow money. And I wrote this May 21st, so it's last month. Constitutional Amendment, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution shall be amended by striking Clause 2 to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Section 1, Clause 8 shall be amended by adding at the end, and Congress shall have no power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, nor to print money to cover expenses greater than revenues. That's it.
That's it. A good deal.
Yeah. Then it says this amendment shall take effect immediately upon ratification. So there's no delay time. So as soon as this is ratified, Congress has no more ability to borrow money. Then I got rationale and background on how it's going to cure inflation and stop the printing of money. It's going to upvalue our money. All your savings are going to increase. Your retirements are going to increase. The market's going to increase. And prices through deflation are going to drop. All those things will happen if we stop Congress from borrowing money.
Never stop a lot of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But the Congress is never going to do it. This has to come from the people in the states. They're going to have to start this process. Very simple. Let me read this again. It says the clause to borrow money on the credit of the United States would be struck, and it would be replaced by, and Congress shall have no power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, nor to print money to cover expenses greater than revenues. There's the solution to like 99% of our economic problems in that one sentence. That's how effective citizen legislation can be.
I'm gonna have to copy that and send it out in my Christmas cards.
Yeah. Let me put it in your Facebook Messenger. In fact, I'll post it again on my page. We've got about 20 minutes left. I'll do it after the show. But yeah, that's a very simple bill. Now, let's think. Now, are the geldings going to support that? No. We know the Democrats aren't going to support it. They live by borrowing money that we don't have. They don't care if we destroy the economy of this country. They don't care one bit. They're economic traitors. This is economic suicide, the course that both these parties have put us on. And the only way to stop them, it's like, how do you stop an alcoholic? You take away all the alcohol. You know, how do you stop Congress from borrowing money? You take away their ability to borrow money. So this balanced budget amendment, this tinkering, all these little restrictions, term limits, it's all BS. If you really want to make change, you take away the power of Congress to borrow money, and that cures almost everything to do with the economy. You know, unless you get another one like Brandon, you know, closing off pipelines and things like that. But as far as everything else goes, there'd be no inflation because they can't print money to beyond revenues. Well, if they can't print money beyond revenues, there's no inflation because the currency remains stable. I mean, it's elegant in its simplicity. I don't know where it came from. This is God-inspired. It's one of those things. I said, well, why don't we just have an amendment that stops Congress from borrowing money? So I did some research to see if there was one. There wasn't. And I saw some articles that had proposed it, but they didn't go more than proposal. It was just a nice article idea. But we actually got it in print. That's the difference. But the GOP establishment has no interest in being the ruling party. So let me get back to the article. We've got about 17 minutes left. Then she says, think about it. The GOP establishment pushed for the second impeachment of Donald Trump, even though Trump was no longer the president and the impeachment was illegal. Perhaps you still recall that moronic theater piece. The entire pointless exercise seemed to be designed by Mitch McConnell to enrage GOP voters. Then the GOP establishment embraced the nomination of Merrick Garland as Brandon's attorney general at the Department of Justice. And Garland repaid that faith by weaponizing the FBI to punish angry parents at school board meetings as, quote, domestic terrorists. That insane and unconstitutional police state maneuver drew mostly yawns from the GOP spineless cowards, or as I call them, the geldings. Let's face facts. The GOP doesn't care to function properly, even as an opposition party in the minority. We are living through the darkest period in American history since the Civil War, and the GOP establishment has continually come to the rescue of the Biden regime to make things worse. How about Biden's insane trillion-dollar infrastructure bill to spark rampant inflation? The GOP helped to pass it. How about Biden's push to create a bogus national holiday called Juneteenth to celebrate the Democrats' constant race baiting? The GOP establishment voted for it, and they did so while the FBI was still arresting GOP voters over a fake insurrection. The Biden regime's DOJ still believes that it can detain Trump voters indefinitely in solitary confinement for the, quote, crime of taking an unauthorized tour of the Capitol, what I call the Capitol Hill Invitational Walk-In. What's the GOP's establishment's view of this grossly unconstitutional violation of the rights of its own voters? Let's just say Lindsey Graham didn't even care to deny the rumor that he personally urged Capitol Police to shoot the protesters on January 6th. Thank you, Lindsey Graham, who sends guns to Ukraine and wants a permanent war there. Back to the article. How about immigration? The GOP establishment blocked President Trump from getting adequate funding for the wall on the southern border for 4 years. And it was Trump's signature campaign issue. To understand the full cynicism of the GOP, just remember, the same people complaining about the border crisis right now are the same people who blocked Trump's wall when they controlled all three branches of government from 2017 to 2018. Let me stop there and get your opinion. The evidence is mounting that the geldings are not only not the opposition, but they're actually supporting the Marxists.
Lindsey Graham really do show his spots, don't he?
See, but he was right, though, with Kavanaugh. When he questioned Kavanaugh about the fact that the Supreme Court has no limitations on the rights they can create when they feel like it, he was absolutely right. But he was so wrong. He actually said, shoot the protesters. You know, during the Capitol Hill walk-in. So he gets it wrong 98% of the time. So I'll tell you when he gets the 2% right. But for the most part, he's a warmonger. You know, loves that permanent war, loves that deep state. Let me tell you another one. The article's not done. She says, how about immigration? The GOP establishment blocked President Trump from – oh, I already read that one. How about vaccine mandates? Let's do that one. As the Brennan regime, my words, forced Americans to take a deadly and experimental drug in 2021, did Mitch McConnell and the GOP have a problem with Americans losing their jobs because they refused to take the jab? Of course not. McConnell, who on his best day still looks like death warmed over, was in complete agreement with the Brandon regime's Chinese-style COVID tyranny, and he made sure the party of limited government, snort, and individual choice, guffaw, did nothing and said nothing while the civil liberties of every American were essentially suspended without notice. Well, that's what we talked about for 2 years. Way back in March 2020, he said, this is illegal. There is no pandemic. We have the cures. We have the treatments. This is all bogus. What did I get for my trouble? Censored. Still to this day, for telling the truth. Where's the GOP? Where's the opposition? You know, ain't there. More on the article. The GOP simply didn't care if the Democrats got you fired from your job and bankrupt and ostracized socially and legally for refusing to get the shot on the orders of the Dr. Mengele of our day, Tony Fauci, who we affectionately call here Dr. Fascist, the genocidal, psychopathic, narcissistic, avaricious, pathologically lying vaccine drug pusher. That's our title for him. I sent that to Emma Robinson too. Haven't heard back. She says the CDC suddenly became the fourth branch of government and suspended property rights and rental contracts unilaterally. Overnight, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights were null and void. Due process disappeared instantly. The GOP cheered this medical tyranny with the valiant exceptions in the Senate of Rand Paul and Ron Johnson all the way. Well, I'd say Ted Cruz to a limited extent too. She says, how much money, one wonders, did Big Pharma give to the GOP to play along? Yeah, that's a good question. So when people ask me if the GOP establishment has any plans to save them or their business or their freedoms or their family from the neo-communist cultural revolution currently taking place in our country, what can I say? I'm not in the business of lying to people. You would have to be out of your mind to still believe that the GOP establishment is fighting against the Biden regime. Yeah, because how many times have I said, Pianki, that they are responsible for keeping it? How many times have I called Mike Pence a traitor? How many times have I said that if they simply put forward the Trump electors, this is all over? And yet they won't do it because they go with the establishment. They protect Brandon, everybody as much as the Democrats do. Right? Haven't we talked about that? Yeah. Then she says, yeah, I'm almost done here. She says, you would have to be out of your mind to still believe that the GOP establishment is fighting against the Biden regime. As America dissolves before your eyes into a tyrannical state ruled by a corporate oligarchy. Yeah, that's the definition of fascism, by the way. The government corporate merging. So big pharma, big tech, big government is the definition of fascism, folks. She says in closing, in point of fact, the GOP establishment is openly fighting alongside Democrats to maintain uniparty rule. These people don't think there are representatives. There are rulers. What do you think? Pretty cool article, huh?
I like that article.
Yep. It's on my Facebook page. It's available from Emerald Robinson. She's right on. And you can imagine she's not getting invited to cocktail parties right now. You know, because she doesn't say what
well,
they want to.
Well, people are not supposed, the common person is not supposed to be able to raise those type of questions and elaborate mm-hmm. on those particular points. That's the way they want it.
Yeah. Give you another quick one here from Emerald Robinson. This is, I guess, last week. Exclusive. Fulton County, that's, I believe, Atlanta, Georgia, gets busted certifying false election results. ex-Dominion employee Dominic Olomo refuses to show election records to Fulton County election officials. She says, today, I've got exclusive coverage of Fulton County elections and the obvious fraud being conducted in Georgia using Dominion voting machines. That's because I've obtained documents from a source who has been in contact with Fulton County election officials, and those documents show that the claims made by Fulton County's IT director and ex-Dominion voting systems employee and Nigerian citizen Dominic Olomo are clearly false. What are we doing with foreign nationals running our elections? You would think you'd have to be an American citizen to be an election official. You would think. Nothing against Nigerians. I just think that everybody who works in an election capacity should be an American citizen. I don't want illegal aliens voting in our – yeah, I don't want illegal aliens. I don't want Canadians, and I'm Canadian by birth. I don't want Canadians in our election officials position because they're Canadian. You know, nothing against Canadians. I am one by birth. But it's just that if you have an American election, you have to have American officials running it. All right. Then she says, let's recap. The Fulton County Board of Oh, I'm not going to do it. But you get the idea. They cheated. So that's just one. Let me see. I'm sort of like trying to find the best news stories of the week.
It's a peculiar story with that, too, mm-hmm. that Democratic primary. You had one Democratic contender who didn't even have a vote from her own district where mm-hmm. she would have voted for herself. And on the recount, which is done June the 1st recount, she won. And they've also found a candidate who was registered to be on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the 24th ballot, they couldn't find his name, but when they done the recount, they found his name.
Yeah, there's so much election fraud in this country. And what people don't understand when they say is, we don't have any proof of vote fraud. Well, we don't have to. See, ballots, unlike people, people are innocent until proven guilty. Ballots are illegal until proven legal. A ballot is suspect until it's proven legal by a legal signature, if it's mail-in, by a chain of custody, by not being not having anybody else interfere with it, by being counted or cast, by not having it be harvested, ballot harvested, by not having someone else fill it in, by not all these things. So once you prove that none of those things happen, then you have a legal ballot. Until then, it's an illegal ballot. And so this idea that there's no evidence of vote fraud is ludicrous. It's laughable. It's hysterical because people think that ballots have to be proven illegal, and they don't. They have to be proven legal. So any violations of chain of command, chain of custody, those ballots are not legal. All right. Here's one for you. From The Defender. Of course, I can't post this. This is from Children's Health Defense. This is Bobby Kennedy's organization. Still trying to get him on. It says, exclusive, more vaccine-injured pilots speak out as groups pressure airlines and regulators to end mandates. So you can fly on an airliner these days, given what, given the pilots are all jabbed? What do you think?
Flip of a coin. It's dangerous.
See, I think you and I should get back current again. We need to do some flying. And so as soon as I get my big sponsors and we get our big break here, whenever that comes, hopefully this year, hopefully before the midterms, and we start having millions of listeners and making some decent money and marketing and all the things I want to do, I'm going to start flying again. And so, yes, I want my jet, my VipriJet Mark II, which is going to cost about $500,000. But that's not bad for a jet. You know, but I might start with a twin Cessna or something like that. We'll see. Point is that I think this is a great time for people to start learning to fly and start flying themselves to different places. And I would love to make flight instruction tax deductible or tax credit, you know, as improving the infrastructure system of the country. We might even call it a national security issue. What do you think? More pilots for national security would be a good thing. So that a pilot's license, you know, sort of like the GI Bill, when people who served in the military could use their GI Bill for flying lessons and presumably go to the airlines. There's a huge pilot shortage. So why can't we do the same thing now? Why can't flight training and anything flight related, pilot related, be a tax credit or at least tax deductible, certainly, but even better, a tax credit, so that as part of our national security system that we have more pilots? I think it's worth exploring.
Yeah, it'd be a good start.
Yeah, especially since the airlines, you know, are such a bad place to travel. The TSA, the requirements, the fact that people are animals on board. I mean, people are horrible on airplanes now. Used to be airline passengers were a pretty civil bunch. Not now. Now they climb over seats, they whack people, they hit them, they yell mask up, they do all kinds of stupid things. But the airlines are, you know, it's just not worth traveling. Of course, all the rich people have their own private jets. So why can't we have a situation where you know, middle-income people can have more access to private aircraft at a lower cost, you know, have a flight instruction reimbursement to ease the burden on the national transportation system? That to me makes sense. Makes sense to fly yourself as opposed to, you know, waiting in the airlines. You know, if I live in Milton, so if I want to go to Pensacola, that's like a half-hour drive, you know, extra security, you know, because you have to go through security. You got to wait. You got to wait to board. There's probably flight delays. You know, there's probably flight delays at the other end. You know, would it be faster flying myself? If I drive out to Milton Airport, hop in my Viper jet, you know, I can probably beat the airlines by several hours. What were you gonna, what would you say? Sounded funny. I missed it. I'm sorry.
It would take you 4 hours. By the time you get through all those obstacles there and at the airport, you could have drove, like you say, but it'd take you about 4 hours in the airport.
Yeah, and my Viper jet, well, even if I had a regular twin doing 200 knots, airliners do about 450 to 500 knots, depending on where they are. You know, so the airliner goes twice as fast. But you still got to get to the airport. You know, you got to check in. You know, you got baggage claim at the other end. You've got all these delays. You got the cab back to the city, all these other things, you know. Whereas you fly from a small airport to a small airport, you know, your flight time is a little bit longer, but everything else is shorter.
You know, well, you could live in a runway community.
Oh, I'd love to do that. That'd be wild. Well, they have in Florida, actually, you have, you'll see people, they have these canals behind their house. Now, some people have Icon A5s. You know, it's an amphibian, right? So you unfold the wings, you know, you hop in your A5, you know, fire it up, taxi down the ramp into the water, and you can take off, you know, once you get outside your canal. So there's your airport. Instead of having a boat, you have an amphibious airplane. That would be
fun. I like those, Seth. I wouldn't want to park my, I wouldn't want to have a plane garage hanging under my house, though.
Mm. Well, it's not under your house. It's actually in the water. It's separate. But there are places like Calaveras County. Yeah. So there's the boat.
Yeah, those do, but
it's a garage.
The other ones I was thinking about, yeah, the garage is underneath your house. You got your plane parked in it. I put it in a different building. Right?
Florida, nothing's underground. It's too wet. Nothing's underground in Florida. No, the garage is beside your house. So you basically, you know, pull your airplane out, unfold the wings, takes about 10 minutes, hop in, fire it up, taxi down the ramp, taxi into the water, retract the gear, and off you go. No fuss, no muss. Easy peasy.
That sounds neat.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be the thing. They're going to vector the sky from their drone-like vehicles, so that's going to be coming.
Yeah. So in other words, I think we're on a rebirth of general aviation in this country. We just have to create the tax situation to help it along. And I actually wrote a bill, the General Aviation Restoration Act, and I'll upgrade it for today. But in terms of COVID and travel and the airlines suck and the energy is too expensive and, you know, there's too many delays anyway. They're still having people take off their shoes for something that happened 25 years ago. You know, it's stupid. Flying by airlines is really dumb. You know, you're much better off. And most airline trips aren't that long anyway. What's the average the average business trip's like 300 miles. I don't know. What's the average airline trip? 300 to 500 miles? Well, it's nothing. You can do that in a small plane without a fuel stop. So people should start flying themselves. Ooh, wouldn't that be interesting? Let me get to this one article, just a little tiny bit of it. It says, we're talking about pilots. It says, sharp chest pains, myocarditis and pericarditis, heart attack, strokes, and subsequent blindness. These are just some of the many COVID-19 vaccine-related adverse effects reported by commercial airline pilots and by a growing number of advocacy groups representing aviation industry workers. Well, pilots are more subject to these things because they operate in a lower oxygen environment. Cabins are pressurized to 8,000 feet, not sea level. It says, according to these individuals and groups, the number of pilots speaking out about their vaccine injuries is dwarfed by the number of pilots who are still flying despite experiencing concerning symptoms, but not speaking out because of what they describe as a culture of intimidation within the aviation industry. So you got pilots that know their health is bad, that are flying anyway, that were forced to take the jab or so they thought, and they're up there dangerous with swollen hearts, heart attacks, strokes, blindness. That's great for a pilot. You want a pilot losing their vision on final? I don't think so. And yet they're doing it because they want to keep their jobs. We got a minute left. Pianki?
Okay. Well, look, you have a safe and sound weekend, and wear your weapon.
I do.
Don't forget to put that Don't forget to put that bill up where I can get a hold of it.
Well, I've done it before, but let me do it again. So the bill we're talking about is the bill that says that Congress can no longer borrow money, because that would do so much for so many things in our economy. 30 seconds left. Yeah, I might as well just say thank you very much, sir, for co-hosting with me this week. And we're still doing it again next week. Monday's show is going to be interesting. It's all the ways that the Brandon administration lost the Ukraine war. So I've got my evidence. The articles are already on my Facebook page for those that are curious. And so Monday I'll do some more research tomorrow after my Gates meeting. We'll see if I can actually talk to him. I'll see what happens, but that's what we're going to do Monday. All right, Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Check all our shows this week, particularly the one yesterday with our greatest doctor panel was incredible. And so also our legislative website, writeyourlaws.com, WRITEYOURLAWS, writeyourlaws.com. And if you want to contribute to Action Radio, you can become a sponsor, and I'll make you a commercial, or you can go directly to our PayPal account at let me see if I can find it here real quickly. I should know where this is, right? Here we go. PayPal.com/PayPalMe/Action Radio. And with that note, back again Monday morning at 7 o'clock Central Time. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday are 7. Thursday is 10 o'clock Central, and Friday is 6 o'clock in the morning Central. All those are morning times. Talk to you later.